All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on the 18th floor overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago. And we're back. It's Monday morning. And yeah, so you know what that means. We got the Monday morning movie reviews coming up with Colin and Eric. Eric, by the way, will be reporting live from Toronto. He's at the Toronto International Film Festival. And he's going to give us some exclusive reviews of some of the new movies that he's seen at the fest. He does this every year, and he covers actually year-round. He covers a lot of the festivals for us, and we get exclusive reviews from Eric. And he's seen a lot of movies, so we're going to get his views on some of those. That's coming up in just a few minutes. And we're going to be talking about the NFL just kicked off this weekend, as you know. And we're going to have the stories behind how all the NFL teams got their names. We're going to talk about some true rock and roll pioneers and a lot more. As always, our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. The best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. We're here every weekday morning from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5, and my main man, Steve Cochran, will have your morning drive at 6. So there you go. Let's say hello to the guys I'm working with this morning, and it's my great producer, Dan Shagrew. Hello, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
All right, man. How about yourself?
Hey, did you have a nice weekend?
Yeah, it was very nice. A guy named John Baird, who's one of my dad's best friends, and actually his daughter, Katie, introduced me to Eileen. He unfortunately passed away from cancer about 10 years ago, and every year they have a golf outing / dinner for him, and that was this past Saturday. So got to see a lot of old friends. And,
yeah. Nice little celebration food. Of the man's life.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, cool. I'm glad you had a good weekend.
Thanks.
In the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hiya, Vic.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
How are you?
Other than having to deal with Jeannie during that Packers comeback,
God, I can't
great. Other
I
than
can't
that,
even imagine. You know,
let me just say, I can't write the checks that my trash talking wrote to her.
And
after
I bet during that first half, you were talking a lot of smack,
giving it to her.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine. Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. Wow, coming from 20 to nothing back. Did you watch the game, Dan?
Couldn't believe it.
I actually tuned out after the first half. I had to turn out after.
And so. You know why I didn't, Dan? I told her if I do that, I'll wake up and they will have lost, and I'll say what? And
yeah.
So at least
you stuck through it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Other than that, though, was your weekend okay?
You know what, though, I did enjoy the game, and I saw an improved team. So I'm actually
there
happy.
Are positives.
Believe it
I
or
would
not,
imagine,
I'm happy,
right? I would imagine there were positives.
There were. There were. Yeah, there were. Absolutely.
Okay. So for those of you who might not know, the traffic cut is now empty, and it looks weird. It's hard to look up at the screen and see that Esmeralda is not in the traffic cut, and the lights are out. Anyway, it makes me very sad. But anyway, Esmeralda, her last show was with us on Friday morning. The company that she works for phased out their radio traffic department. And as a result, thousands of people across the country have lost their jobs. And she is no longer a part of the show on a regular basis, like on a daily basis. But she's not going to be gone. We're going to bring her back for a periodical For the Record fun and the Music IQ, and of course would Esmeralda buy that, and we'll have her on just as a guest every once in a while. Her voice is still going to be heard on the show. Unfortunately, it won't be heard throughout the entire 4 hours every morning like it has been for 3 years. So it's kind of sad to look up at this, seeing that. And then I know that, you know, Vic, you guys were like 4 feet away from each other, you know, throughout the night, and you guys can talk and stuff like that during breaks and things.
Yeah, we really became buddies up here, so it's going to be, I'm definitely going to feel it as well.
Rough transition.
Yeah.
It's going to be a rough transition.
But,
And you're doing the traffic now. How's that going for you? That was your first time.
Yeah, it's going great. It's a blast.
Well, we are not doing. We used to do breaks starting at 3:45. We would do a 3:45 traffic break, 4:15 traffic break, and a 4:45 traffic break. We're no longer doing those because Vic, in addition to doing traffic, he's got to write the news. So
right, and I went through some training, and they brought me up to speed. It's been a busy last 72 hours with that, and I'll do the best I can. I got some big shoes to fill. She's been doing it a long time. She's very good at it, So
absolutely,
but I'll do the best
I
can.
Vic is in the newsroom doing a lot of work, and he'll be here until 5 a.m. So there you go. So I had a pretty fun weekend, Dan.
Yeah.
My favorite band of all time, Buffalo Tom, played at the Metro on Saturday night. And I went, and it was very strange because, you know, there was a Fall Out Boy concert happening across the street at Wrigley. And it was funny because, you know, as we were, because my parents gave me a lift to the Metro. We came straight from seeing a movie, and they dropped me off at the Metro. And as we were driving through the neighborhood, I was like, look, you can definitely point out the Fall Out Boy fans from the Buffalo Tom fans. Because the Buffalo Tom fans will be mostly middle-aged men with either beer guts or beer belly or gray hair. And the Fall Out Boy crowd will be younger, much, much younger, teenagers and the like. And it was so funny to point them out. I mean, it was so, like, you could point out, like, two guys walking down the street. I'm like, those guys are in their 40s. They are going to Buffalo Tom. There's no question about it. You know, and the crowd consisted mostly of middle-aged men like me, who've been listening to the band, you know, for almost 30 years. And so, anyway, I can call myself friends with Bill Janovitz, who is the lead singer and songwriter and guitarist. And it was great. They were fantastic. They did two sets. The first set was all a bunch of different songs, and the second set was all of their classic album, Let Me Come Over, and they were celebrating the 25th anniversary of that album. And during the first set, Bill called me out on stage. Not on stage, but on stage, he said, hey, Nick DiGilio, one of our biggest supporters is Nick DiGilio from WGN Radio. I actually got a round of applause from some people. And he dedicated the song Wiser to me. And that was unbelievable. I didn't expect it. He didn't tell me he was going to do it. And lots of fun backstage stuff that I can talk about a little bit later on. But it was a fantastic show. It was a great show. But it was a real pain in the ass to get home, because Fall Out Boy was letting out right around the same time. So it's like 45,000 people walking down Clark. Very difficult. But anyway, it was a fantastic night. And again, they were great. And I want to thank Bill for just being a cool dude. The whole band, Tom and Chris as well. Just great guys. Anyway, that was a fun weekend. And if you were there, you know, you saw a great show. All right, I'll tell you a little bit more about that a little bit later. But right, we're going to break because we want to bring Eric and Colin in here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on the 18th floor, overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago. Here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. The NFL season has kicked off, so we're going to tell you how the NFL teams got their names as well. And we're going to talk about some rock and roll pioneers all this morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. For talk and text. You can also check us out on Twitter. Follow us at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday morning. That means we've got the Monday morning movie reviews to do. We'll talk box office, but also we're right in the middle of the Toronto Film Festival. Eric Childress, who reviews the movies with us every Monday, always goes to the film festivals and does exclusive live reports for us. And he's going to do that this morning as well. And he is live in Toronto. So let's first of all welcome Eric. Eric, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Now you didn't see any of the new movies for this week, right?
No, I have not.
Okay. All right. So let's get Colin in here then. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm coming down with something, but I'm all right. I can do this.
Okay. All right. Well, what should we do first? Should Colin and I just review the new ones and then we can cut Colin loose?
Yeah, do that.
Especially if you're feeling under the weather, Colin?
Yeah, sure. That sounds good.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start with The Nun. Colin, tell everybody about The Nun.
All right. Well, this is another origin story for the Conjuring series, and this one takes place in 1952 at a convent in Romania, where at the beginning of the film, a nun takes her own life after being confronted and haunted by an evil spirit. And she's found by this local delivery man, gardener, who goes by the name of Frenchie, and he's played by Jonas Bloquet. And he ends up being a bit of a guide for a priest and a nun-to-be who are investigating this whole thing. And they're played by Damien Bashir and Taissa Farmiga. And they're investigating the thing at the request of the Vatican. And, of course, over the next few days, they get lured into dark hallways and graveyards and churches where an evil spirit who looks like a nun haunts them and entraps them in a variety of ways. So this is this one's directed by Corin Hardy. And I've not seen really any of his other work. I think he made a movie called 71, that I liked, if I'm thinking of the same guy. I think we all really enjoyed the Conjuring movies very much, or at least Derek and I did. Were you neutral on them?
I like the first one. I'm neutral on the second one.
Okay. But, you know, this has been a pretty good series of films. And, the first Annabelle sucked, and then the second one was pretty good, if I remember correctly. This one just kind of, it neither sucks nor is it great. It kind of falls somewhere in the middle. There's atmospheric things that I like about it. Visually there's some good creepy imagery going on here, and I do like the kind of old fashioned haunted atmosphere of smoky graveyards, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with the book series Scary Stories, but some of the images in this movie remind me of some of the illustrations in those books, which I kind of liked. There's one sequence that stuck out to me that I thought was pretty effective was a scene involving burial. But the rest of the movie just feels kind of flat and uninspired. I mean, as interesting and as kind of fun as some of these sort of old fashioned tropes are, the actual execution of the scenes themselves kind of feel a little stale and don't really bring anything new to the story, or it doesn't really bring any new life into this whole universe that they've created here for these films. It's just kind of, your sort of average, your typical characters who get to investigate this stuff. The Tessa Farmiga character, she hasn't really taken her vows yet to be a nun. That's a point constantly brought up in the film. It would have been nice if there was some kind of character element there other than just a formality. I appreciate that the local delivery guy, I appreciate that they try to use him as comic relief, especially later in the film. But those moments pretty much fall flat and they're kind of uninspired. So I don't know. This is not a terrible film, but it's also not particularly memorable either. So I'd say pass on it.
I'm with you pretty much 100%, Colin, and the whole thing. I really like the look of the film. I think the production design is great, and the photography is really good. And you're right. I mean, it does have these really beautiful, creepy imagery. Images in it. There are, your basic amount of jump scares, and I think a lot of these movies rely on that too much. And after a while, it gets kind of numbing. You know what I mean? Like after the 50th jump scare, you're like, all right. I mean, come on, let's stop.
Yeah, you see him coming.
Absolutely. I didn't really care about any of the characters very much. The burial sequence that you're talking about, I think, is the best thing in the movie. But I'm not recommending this one either. I think the casting of are they just going to have the whole Formiga family in these movies? Is that the idea? So I don't know. But it made a ton of money over the weekend.
Yeah.
And Eric, it made $53 million.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's crazy, man.
Warner Brothers hit on a new formula, which is to release a big horror movie at the beginning of September. I mean, yeah. They did it last year with It, and now it's this one, and now it's like, well, I guess every year now they're going to do that.
Yeah. And then people went out in droves to see this thing.
Yeah.
It was packed when I saw it. It was completely packed. People seem to enjoy it. But again, it's not terrible. It's just, you know what I mean? There's really nothing, in terms of characters, there's nothing to latch on to. There are a couple of moments that are kind of creepy. The photography is really good, the set design, makeup, and stuff like that. So technically, this is good stuff. They do a really good job with it, and they bring on the atmosphere, which is nice, but there's really should be a story and more than just jump scares to go along with what is basically just great atmosphere. So, all right. Colin, I agree with you 100% on that one.
All right.
Okay, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Eric Childress is live from the Toronto Film Festival. He's going to give us exclusive reviews of a bunch of movies that he's seen at the festival. Colin Suter is with us. When we come back, we got one more movie to review. Colin and I will review it, and then we'll cut Colin loose and then talk with Eric about the Toronto Film Festival and box office as well. That's all coming up right here after the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, high above downtown Chicago, Illinois, on a Monday morning. And that means Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now. And also, Eric Childress is live in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival. And he's going to give us exclusive rundowns of the movies that he's seen as part of that festival. We'll do box office as well. Monday means my dad will call in and tell a joke. That's coming up later on because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about how the NFL teams got their names and some rock and roll pioneers and more. As always, our phone number for talk and text is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, let's get back to it. Eric is hanging out for a couple of minutes here before we start talking about the films at Toronto. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Colin, tell us about Peppermint.
All right. Well, this is a revenge thriller starring Jennifer Garner as Riley North. Just remember that because her name is mentioned 1,000 times in this movie. And she's a woman who works at a bank, has a husband and a kid, and is trying to make ends meet. And 5 years ago, her husband got mixed up with, or a friend of her husband's got mixed up with a drug cartel, and by extension, her husband got mixed up with it, too, a little bit. Long story short, they find him, and they gun him down, and their daughter, and they thought they got Riley, too, but they didn't. And now it's 5 years later, and she has been off the grid this whole time. She's been traveling around the globe, learning about combat and fighting skills, and is now back for revenge on, you know, her husband and child's killers. And a detective and an FBI agent have been trying to track her down. They're played by Jeff Hefner and Annie Ilanza. And now they are a string of murders taking place in and around the Skid Row area, all related to this L.A. drug cartel. And they're convinced it's her, Jennifer Garner, that is, and they're right. It's her. So this is pretty much your standard revenge story. You know, you're taking every man or every woman and just, you know, sticking in this, this horrible situation. And then they come back 5 years later, they get revenge and start taking these guys down one by one who are responsible. There's really nothing to add to that. And, you know, nobody in this movie behaves like a human being. They pretty much behave, they pretty much exist to propel the plot forward and to get to the next action scene, which with the high body count. On the plus side, it is directed by Pierre Morel, who's the director of the first Taken and District B-13. So this guy knows his way around really fast and unmerciful action scenes that are, and when I say unmerciful, I mean in their violence, but they're very quick and fast-paced, which is how I like my action scenes. So I like the way this guy directs them. Unfortunately, there's just nothing special about this movie to really separate it. I mean, at least District B-13, at least you had the parkour and you had the crazy sort of plot anyway with the whole Paris being locked down thing. Taken, you got Liam Neeson as a strong, you know, action hero as they come nowadays. And you know, his style of throat punching is, of course, very memorable. And Jennifer Garner is, you know, obviously she's had experience in stuff like this before. And so she's very capable and she's got the charisma. But, you know, the script just doesn't let her do anything else except, you know, do kind of a John Wick imitation, which is not very interesting. And her, you know, there's not much in the way of context given by the screenwriter. There's times when we're just not quite sure at what point in time we are, how, you know, how many days have gone by, you know, and it's just kind of, you know, it's very choppy. It's a very choppy film. And, you know, the sort of, it's also a bit, you know, kind of tone deaf in a way that is, it's kind of a racist movie.
Yeah,
too.
I wouldn't say kind of.
Yeah.
I would not say kinda.
Not kind of. But it's like, really, we're still doing the Mexican drug cartel thing, and we're going to gun them down in a shop that sells piñatas, or it's a factory that makes piñatas.
That was the moment right there, Colin, when she's like gunning down 20 Hispanics in a piñata factory. I'm like, are you serious?
It's funny because
before I saw the movie, I saw it on Saturday, and Peter Subskinski, you know, our friend Peter.
Yes.
He had seen it, and he said, he posted on it, you know, he posted on Facebook, he said, I don't want to say that Peppermint is racist, but Jennifer Garner kills 20 Hispanics in a piñata factory, and I thought he was joking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's Peter, you know his sense of humor.
Yes. Yes.
I thought he was joking. I was like, yeah, that's funny, and then the scene starts happening, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah,
he's
right?
Serious.
But there are, I mean, the one kind of trope in it that I found kind of a nice throwback. I don't know if it's probably not intentional. It's just a dumb script, and it's a dumb trope too. But like, you know, using Skid Row as a location, you know, and actually saying it and seeing, you know, canisters filled with fire and these homeless people pushing shopping carts, prophesizing about the angel. I was like, you know, that's very kind of sort of a B grade, you know, sort of an 80s B grade movie trope, B movie trope, that I just kind of like chuckled at a little bit.
Right.
But this is kind of a waste of Jennifer Garner. It's a stale storyline. It's a stale execution, and it's racist. So
good. I add to all of that. And the thing that I found really sort of amazing about this movie is that, like, the three guys who do the drive by, okay, and kill her family at the beginning of the movie when the three guys, you don't even get to see them get killed. You know what I mean?
True.
Like, those are the guys. Those
quick.
Are the guys that killed her family, and then it's for the rest of it. She's trying to track down the head of the drug cartel. I'm like, wait a minute! You did your job already. You got revenge against the guys who killed your family.
Since she was able to finger them, in the lineup when she probably didn't. I mean, I don't know how anybody could have actually remembered those faces from that far back and as dark as it was and chaotic as it was, but she apparently did. And we're supposed to go with that,
right?
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it makes no sense. And all the stuff at the end, I mean, it's horribly stereotypical, you know, the Vatos and all that stuff. Like, really?
Yeah.
Come on, man. And also, one of the lessons learned in this movie is never trust a guy with a face tattoo. That's
right.
You always suspect a guy with a face tattoo. And on top of that, the dialogue between John Gallagher Jr. and John Ortiz, who play the two cops, is horrible. It's so stupid and cliched, and I can't stand this. And you know, when a screenwriter who's making a cop movie or a movie, or a thriller or a shoot 'em up movie, and they use the sentence, "If you do that, you're gonna get dead." I hate that. It's just the stupid, and they do it like four. It's like four times in this movie. Yeah, you go to that. You're going to that neighborhood. You get dead. Like, what are you?
Yeah.
What is that supposed to be? And again, you know, I mean, this guy does know how to direct action sequences, so they're fast and there's an impactful stuff to them. They're very violent. It's an extremely violent movie. But I mean, the guy can cut and stage action well, but there's nothing else behind this movie. It is really, really bad.
So, did I miss something? Like, it's called Peppermint because of the Girl Scout cookies that her kids are selling.
I think it's because of the ice cream cone. Because the daughter has a peppermint ice cream cone.
Okay, I missed that.
I will say this, Colin. I'd seen, obviously they showed a lot of TV commercials for this before it came out, and in one of the commercials is a scene that is not in the movie, and she's talking to her daughter and says that she's made up of love and heart and peppermint.
Oh.
And they cut that out of the movie. It's the title of the movie, and they cut that scene out, explaining why it's the title of the movie. So now you're left to believe that it's because the kid had a peppermint ice cream cone the night she got killed. That's the
thing. And I even missed that. I thought it was because she was selling Thin Mint cookies. I'm like, this could have been called Thin Mint? Really? Okay.
So, did she leave any, like, on like any of the bodies as her calling card, like peppermint patty wrappers?
No. She hangs the three guys from a Ferris wheel, though. The three guys that ice her kid, she hangs them from the Ferris wheel, which is where they were the night that they got killed. They were at a fair.
Okay.
So it's a terrible movie, Eric. It's a terrible movie. So if you see it, you might get dead.
Oh, good. Well, I'm not going.
Okay, good. All right. Next week, before we cut Colin loose, we've got The Predator, which I know, Eric, you've already seen.
I have.
A Simple Favor, which is this really interesting looking Paul Feig movie that I can't quite figure out from the trailers, but it looks really intriguing. And then what else is next week? There's another big one.
I think it's White Boy Rick comes out next week.
White Boy Rick. Yeah, White Boy Rick comes out next week. It's a new McConaughey movie based on the true story about a 15-year-old drug kingpin and FBI informant based on a true story. And then, Eric, you've seen a movie called Mandy.
I have, yes.
And we'll talk about that.
And I will be seeing it.
And you will be seeing it. So we've got those movies are coming up next week to see. So, Colin, get some rest, okay, buddy?
All right, thanks,
all right,
man.
There you go. All right. So that's what we got next week. Some bigger movies are coming out, and we'll get to those as well. So that's coming up. Make sure you tune in for us next week for another set of Monday morning movie reviews. Now we're going to take a break. Eric, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Eric Childress is in Toronto. He's at the Toronto International Film Festival live, and he's going to come back and give us some exclusive reviews of movies that he's seen so far at that fest. He does this every year at Toronto, and he does all the other film festivals and covers them for us as well. So we'll get some thoughts on his movies from Toronto right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6 o'clock is Steve Cochran with your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in later on and tell the jokey time. We're going to talk about some classic rock and roll pioneers. And we're also going to let you know how the NFL teams got their names on this, the kickoff of the NFL season weekend. So our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we are finished up the movie reviews. A couple of bad movies open this week. The Nun isn't terrible, but it's not good. And Peppermint is terrible. So we got those done. And Eric is sticking around. Eric is live in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival, and we're going to get some exclusive reviews of movies that he's seen. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right. Now, how many years have you been going to the fest?
Since 2004.
Wow. So 14 years.
14 years, yeah.
Yeah, wow. All right. Well, cool. And now, how long have you been there?
Since Wednesday night.
Okay.
Wednesday night. So the festival started on Thursday, so I'm four days in right now.
And how many movies have you seen?
On the ground, I've seen 19 movies.
Oh, man. All right.
And I skipped one this morning but up late last night just doing a midnight show.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to catch up with that later in the week.
Okay.
We'll talk about that next week.
All right, cool. All right, well, and how long are you there? You're staying until when?
Through Thursday.
Through Thursday, okay.
Well, not all Thursday. I'll be here for a little bit on Thursday, then I'm coming home on Thursday.
Okay. All right. Well, wherever you want to start, we always love to hear your reviews, and some of these will be coming out soon. Most of them, actually, will be coming out soon, and some of them won't, but we want to hear which ones would you like to start with?
Well, I'd actually like to start with my top two, which I saw this very day, or last night, actually.
Okay.
Two extraordinary tales of heroism, and one of them has a release date, is coming out in October, and you can expect it to be a monster Oscar player, and that's Damien Chazelle's First Man.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait. I saw, Eric, I can't remember what movie we saw. Oh, when we saw Mission Impossible in IMAX, they showed 10 minutes of First Man, and it was the
film.
in IMAX.
I can't imagine they showed like the landing or anything.
Well, they showed the launch. They showed one of the launches.
They showed the launch.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's as they're walking in, and the fluorescent lights are swinging back and forth, and they get into the module and all that stuff. That sequence they showed. It's like it was an 8-minute sequence, and it was fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. And the thing about this one, I mean, you know, you, Colin, and I years ago got to see the right stuff in the park.
Yes.
Years ago, and that's a very seminal movie in my life. It's a very important movie personally to me, mm-hmm. but I also think it's also an all-timer. And I think now that we kind of have, I think, is kind of a definitive cinematic trilogy of the space program with the right stuff, with this, and kind of concluding with Apollo 13 in a way. Mm-hmm. I think those three movies kind of show this incredible arc of what this period of, you know, American technological history really was, and pretty much covers all aspects of it, and a lot of that is covered here in First Man, too. But what Chazelle does, I mean, obviously this is the story of Neil Armstrong and the first moon landing, and, you know, we've seen, you know, first of all, it's remarkable that this story has never been told before on screen, that we've never had a movie specifically about this thing. You know, I mean, it's been From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO miniseries and that, but we never had an actual film about this, and it would have been so easy to just do the rah-rah, to just do, you know, the blazing music, and, you know, we feel really great at the end of the movie and all that stuff, but there's a real unique, dry approach to this film that works in spades, because it's a very personal story about Neil Armstrong. The focus is very much on him and his family, but you know, without at any point letting go of just how much effort, you know, is put into, you know, making one of these things happen. I mean, the movie covers pretty much, I think, like about a 6-7 year period leading up to the actual flight. And what this movie really focuses on is just precisely how dangerous these missions were. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we see, you know, every time you see one of these rockets launch, we're in the right stuff, even Apollo 13, you know, the music is blaring, we're, you know, we can't believe we did it. It all, you know, there are issues here and there, but it seems to go beautifully in a way. It's like, hey, we finally did it. And here, you know, they put you right inside those capsules and right inside that rocket when it's going, and it is just, it's clunky and noisy, and it just looks like hell.
Yeah, well, that sequence, you know, the sequence that they showed us, the date was like insane.
And there's so much of that in the movie, because there are other flights. I mean, it takes you through, you know, a lot of the tragedies that happened during that period at NASA. I mean, I'm very well versed in this period, so when certain things happen up, I was just like, oh no, you know, watching this thing. And, you know, it's a remarkable performance by Gosling. It's a really beautiful performance, you know, because if you know anything about Armstrong's family history, this movie opens with, you know, something really horrific. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I sort of compared it in a way to, we were talking about this because we actually saw the movie in IMAX.
Oh, yeah, good. That's cool.
We saw it in the IMAX screen here at Toronto. And we were talking about how the movie kind of frames why Neil Armstrong went to the moon in a way. And I sort of framed it in a way compared with E.T., where Spielberg said about E.T. that, you know, the greatest tragedy in Elliot's life was his father divorcing his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that could fill that hole in his life would be the most extraordinary thing that could ever happen to him, and that was an alien coming down. And that's kind of what you kind of feel with when Armstrong finally, you know, kind of just sits back and kind of, you know, takes stock of where he's at on the moon. And it's a really, you know, I mean, seriously, Nick, you're going to be crying, I think, by the end of this movie.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful film. It's going to be up for a ton of Oscars. Chazelle is the man.
Yeah.
He, you know, he didn't have to tell the story the way he did. But he found, I mean, they're just in the flight sequences alone, there are angles and things that we've never seen in, you know, movies or stock footage or anything like that. It's a remarkable accomplishment.
All right, great. Eric, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. That was First Man, which opens in October, and it's Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong. And a great word of mouth. Obviously, the buzz has been good on this. No pun intended. And Eric just gave it a phenomenal review. So, all right, we got to take a break for the news. When we come back, more from the Toronto Film Festival after this on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We did the Monday morning movie reviews, and now we're getting a special live report from Eric Childress, who is at the Toronto Film Festival right now and has seen 19 movies while he's been there. He's going to see a bunch more too, and we'll get another report from him next week. But we're getting some great reports from him now, and he just reviewed Damien Chazelle's First Man, which is about Neil Armstrong, starring Ryan Gosling, and gave it a fantastic review. And let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, how's Claire Foy in it? Because she rules.
Terrific. I think that she could very, very easily get a nomination for the movie.
Good, because I love her.
Whether she goes lead or supporting, that could be debatable. But I think that she's got more than a few Oscar clips in the movie.
Yeah.
That I think she's going to get nominated.
She's going to have a good fall because she's got that Girl in the Spider's Web coming out too. So it's going to be
Bane earlier. So
yeah, good year for her. All right. Okay. Now, you said the other one that you saw yesterday was also, last night, was also pretty amazing. Did you want to talk about that one?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Another tale of heroism, and one that probably not as many people clearly know as much as the moon landing.
Right.
But it's a much more horrific tale, and it's called Hotel Mumbai.
Uh-huh.
And this is the true story of 10 years ago, 2008, I believe. Where a group of organized terrorists, basically laid waste to a number of tourist locations in Mumbai, India. They went to restaurants, cafes, and they weren't looking for money, hostages, anything. They just opened fire and laid waste to the place. And the movie, starts off with that stuff, but it leads them towards what comes to be known as Hotel Mumbai, this very posh, very swanky, beautiful hotel in the center of the city. A lot of rich people go there. They cater to everything. It's just a beautiful, gorgeous location. And the terrorists, a group of four terrorists get in there, and seriously, they just start shooting. And Dev Patel plays one of the workers at the hotel. Armie Hammer plays one of the guests of the hotel. Jason Isaacs plays a Russian guest of the hotel. And it's about this terrorist incident, but it's also about those who were how desperate they were to survive. We've seen how many terrorist movies, from Die Hard to Skyscraper, this is the real thing. This is not a movie where, you're waiting for the good guy to, escape his, find the right moment and grab the gun from
right,
the terrorist.
Right.
That's not this kind of movie. This was real life, and, we're talking, over 100 people killed.
Jeez.
At least of the reports in the movie. Were killed during these attacks, and the movie does a remarkable job of introducing us to characters, making us remember a lot of characters, not just the famous names in the movie, but a lot of the supporting characters in the film, the workers, people who stayed behind at the hotel to do whatever they can to keep these people safe. And I'm telling you, there are moments in this movie that rival A Quiet Place, and how you just want to remain silent so the terrorists don't find these people. This is not some cheap exploitation thing like that No Escape movie with Owen Wilson a few years ago.
Right. Oh God,
it's not that kind of movie. This is the real thing, trying to document this unbelievably horrific incident, and it's going to have a lot of people holding their breath, covering their eyes. It's a rough movie to watch because it is unsparingly violent in its depiction of the slaughter that goes on. But it had me from frame one to the very end. It wasn't even on my schedule. I couldn't fit it into my schedule. They added a screening last night, and it just happened to fit. So I went to it, and I was floored by it.
Wow. Okay, that's Hotel Mumbai. And I'm looking at the director. It's his first feature.
Yeah. So. It's a remarkable debut from this guy. Anthony Maris?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it doesn't have a distributor yet. I can't imagine that's going to go for too long. I mean, it's not easy from the market.
Yeah, sure.
At all.
Yeah.
But some studio is going to want to have their names attached to this one because it's a pretty incredible piece of work.
Okay. All right. So that's Hotel Mumbai. Keep your eyes peeled for that one. All right, Eric, where do you want to go next?
Well, let's go to a couple of the midnight films. Right. You mentioned The Predator earlier, and I won't talk too much about this because we're going to be reviewing it more next week.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, Shane Black's, you know, new version of The Predator, new follow-up to the story. And what can I say? It's fun. You know, it's a Shane Black movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if that's what if you like that, whether it be, you know, Lethal Weapon or Long Kiss Goodnight or The Nice Guys, this is a Shane Black movie through and through. It is filled with a lot of humor. It's very much more in the terms of, like, the A-Team than, like, the original Predator, where there, you know, it was all serious. It was all hands on deck and all business and whatnot.
Yeah.
This one, they're cracking jokes. Your boy Thomas Jane and Keegan-Michael Key are, like, I mean, seriously, you want a spin-off movie with those two guys. Thomas Jane gets to do stuff in this movie that's cooler than anything he did in The Punisher.
Mm.
And he also plays a guy that has Tourette's.
Okay.
So, added fun.
And he's, I'm really looking forward to this movie because I happen to think Shane Black makes enormously entertaining movies. I'm one of the few people, I really loved what he did with Iron Man 3. I know I'm kind of alone on that, but I love.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that one.
I just love the ballsy move that he did with the villain.
That was fun. That part was fun. That was the thing I liked about that movie.
Yeah.
The rest of it, not so much.
But I'm really looking forward to it. And I love the idea of some of the casting in this movie. I mean, I love the fact that Olivia Munn is in it and Keegan-Michael Key. I mean, I'm just really looking forward to it.
Yeah, Jacob Tremblay in the movie. Sterling K. Brown having a lot of fun as the jerky government guy.
Yeah.
That wants to capture the Predator.
Yeah.
He's having a blast. You can tell the entire cast is having a blast with this movie. You know, and it's just fun.
Yeah.
It just ultimately comes up as fun. There are a couple things that are some clunky in it, but I had fun.
Good.
You know, it kept me awake at midnight. And,
yeah. Well, I can't wait. I'm very excited to see it. So we'll see that. We'll review that again in full next Monday.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. We'll get into it more next week.
What else did you get into then?
Well, there was a little midnight movie last week or the other night that you and I texted about briefly, and it's David Gordon Green's Halloween.
Yep,
which I'm sure the entire world was skeptical of when they first heard of the project. Then the trailers came out, and all of a sudden, some of us, like you and I, were being turned around on this thing. Maybe this thing's going to work. Maybe they understand, you know, the history of Halloween and all this. I think it's pretty bad.
Yeah,
Nick,
I'm really disappointed. And some people I know are like really confused by the timeline here. But basically, this is a direct sequel to the first Halloween. So all of the other Halloweens don't exist in this world.
Correct,
and he's also not Laurie Strode's brother.
Right. They actually, there's a snarky little line in the movie where they say that, you know, that's just something that some people made up to make a connection or something like that.
Right.
So there's a line, and there's a lot of lines like that. You know, I mean, first I will have to say that knowing you as a non Danny McBride fan,
yeah,
his voice is all over the humor in this movie. Because, you know, that's what you go to expect in a Halloween movie, is the humor.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of it in this movie. You know, it was interesting talking about Predator and Love Predator and Halloween back-to-back. because Shane Black knows how to insert humor and to insert, you know, kind of, you know, snarky references to the, you know, the history of the series and, you know, the kind of the jokes that, you know, fans even make in the movie. Halloween, you know, it doesn't fit very well. And what I kept saying, the thing that struck me when I was walking home or walking back to the hotel from the movie the other night is that very thing that you mentioned, that they've thrown out all the other sequels.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so you clearly think that the rest of these movies are not up to the par of John Carpenter's original.
Right.
Okay. So you have a responsibility now to be that direct sequel. You actually, I mean, because the thing I thought going into the movie, I'm like, okay, well, this could be Rocky Balboa.
Yeah.
It's not going to be Rocky, but you could theoretically throw out 2 to 5 and just watch Rocky and Rocky Balboa back to back and think that those are a perfectly good sequel
right.
to the original film.
Right.
Halloween doesn't live up to the mediocrity of the sequels.
Mm.
You know, and I'm talking the later sequels. You know, I think Halloween 2 is a better film.
Oh, boy. Well, yeah. I mean, I, of all the sequels, the only one that I actively like is H2O. That's the only one of the sequels that I really, really, really like.
I can't even go with you there either. But one of our colleagues who also does agree with you too that he likes H2O better than this new one. Said that the angle of the Laurie survivor aspect in H2O is handled much better than it is here, because here they completely just rip off the Terminator 2 thing.
Right.
It just, you know, Laurie was, you know, had a horrible traumatic incident. She then trained herself to become a warrior. She passed it down to her kids, who then grew up to resent her. That's the basic arc of that story, and it doesn't work. And they load up on the body count in this movie. I was really curious to see what Green and McBride were going to do with the gore in this movie, and they amp it up to zombie-like levels.
Oh, man.
And that's Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
You know, and there's one moment in the movie where I wrote down my notes, I'm like, this is Michael Myers, not Jason Voorhees.
Right.
Okay? And you'll know what moment I'm talking about there. There's another moment in the climax where I kind of checked out for good. I'm like, really? That's where you want to take this story?
Yeah.
And then there's another moment involving Judy Greer where it completely dawned on me, like, these guys don't even seem to understand who Michael Myers was and what works so well about Halloween, because David Gordon Green is out of his element here.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how to set up set pieces. He doesn't know how to pay them off. The ancillary characters who are just, you know, body count fodder are straight out of Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, are you doing a gag on an entire genre? Are you doing Scream here, guys? Or are you trying to do a direct sequel to one of the greatest horror movies of all time?
Yeah.
This is a failure,
okay.
I'm sorry to say.
All right, I'm really disappointed.
Don't lose the hype.
Yeah, okay. All right, Eric, hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right, Eric Childress live from Toronto giving me some very disappointing news. we'll come back with more. He's got exclusive reviews of more movies. He's up in Toronto, and we'll do that right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke a little bit later on. And, we got a lot of other stuff coming up, too. We're going to talk about some rock and roll pioneers. We're going to talk about, NFL season kicked off this weekend, so we're going to give you the stories behind where the NFL teams got their names. And also, we're going to talk about sounds that kids nowadays probably have never heard or would have no idea what they were if they heard them. Another topic to make us feel old. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Eric Childress is live from Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival. He goes every year. This is his 14th year going, and he's seen a bunch of movies. We got a negative review from Halloween, a fun review from The Predator, and two great reviews from Hotel Mumbai and First Man, the movie about Neil Armstrong with Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy. And we've got more to talk about. Eric is up in Toronto. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, you got to be as surprised as me that The Nun made $53.5 million over the weekend, right?
Yeah, I was thinking low 40s.
Yeah,
honestly, I was thinking like high 30s, low 40s. The thing they were saying 46 when I first saw the numbers on Friday. I'm like, okay, that just sounds about right. then Saturday it was 50, and then today it was, what, 53?
53.5, yeah. It's crazy.
Incredible. Incredible.
And what did it cost? I mean,
nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I mean, it's not like Blumhouse level, but like the Annabelle and the Conjuring movies are usually in like the $30 to $40 million range.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like it made like another $70 million overseas already. So I mean, this thing is practically in profit already.
There you go. All right. Well, we'll get to some box office stuff a little bit later on. All right. Toronto movies. Where do you want to go next?
Well, let's get a little political. Okay. There's a couple of political movies that I've seen. One of them that we'll be reviewing a little more fuller in a few weeks, and that's Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 11/9.
Right.
And this, you know, this is a film that, you know, people, you know, Michael Moore fans at least, have been waiting for to see his, you know, this sort of definitive take on Donald Trump. And the thing that's actually, you know, the thing that's not surprising about the film is precisely how angry this movie is. I mean, I think in all of the movies that he's done, the level of anger displayed throughout this film, and I got to say, you know, maybe not evenly balanced, but he doesn't, you know, pull any punches. I mean, he goes after Republicans, Democrats, you know, everything in this movie. And in some ways, it plays in a way like a kind of like a retrospective of Michael Moore's entire filmography, because you'd actually be kind of surprised for a good portion of this movie how little Trump is actually in it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this movie takes the wise approach of not trying to keep up with the Trump news as far as, you know, like, you know, charting all of the missteps that's been made over the last 20 months.
Yeah.
Basically. But it goes prior to that. It goes up, you know, to ask the question, how did he get elected?
Right.
And it really doesn't go into the Russia stuff that much. For that, I actually recommend a really great documentary called Active Measures that's available online right now. That's a full Russia retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
But this is all about, you know, his tendencies, how the joke of him running for president became a reality. And then the movie, it takes like side trips. Like, it actually, there's a section of the movie that actually steers his way back to Flint, Michigan to talk about the water crisis.
Sure, yeah.
And there's very, I mean, other than Trump, you know, the way he connects Trump to being enamored with how Rick Snyder was able to get away with this whole thing, mm-hmm. there's really not a lot of Trump in that section. It's all about Flint. It shifts over to the, you know, the Parkland shootings, and has all of those, you know, all the kids from that that movement in it. So I mean, this movie it kind of rambles at times. It just kind of goes from topic to topic, and then steers itself back to Trump, and then, you know, puts his voice in Hitler's mouth. You know, so typical Moore type stuff.
Right.
But I do have to say that it is his best film since Sicko. It is rambling. There are a couple moments in the movie that are very Moore-ish that I have to sort of double check the facts and see exactly if he's on point with some of these things or if he's glossing. There are a couple moments where it's like, you seem to be glossing over a couple things there to make your point.
Right.
And I always hate it when he does that. But it's a good film. I think Active Measures that's available right now is a more important film. But this is, you know, if you're angry before, you're going to be angry walking out of this as well.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on, okay? Hold on a second.
Sure.
Eric Childress is with us. That's Fahrenheit 11/9, which will be coming out at the end of this month. It's Michael Moore's new documentary about Trump. So, Eric saw it in Toronto. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more with Eric in Toronto right here on 720 WGN. And welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. My dad will call in later to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some great rock and roll pioneers, 11 noises that kids wouldn't recognize or never heard before nowadays. And because the NFL season kicked off, we're going to tell you how all the NFL teams got their names. Plus more. Phone lines are always open. Text lines are always open. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking with Eric Childress right now. He is in the he's in Toronto at the Toronto International Film Festival. He's seen a bunch of movies, and he's telling us about the ones that he's seen. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, now you said that, so that was the first of a political film that you wanted to talk about, which was Fahrenheit 11/9. What was the other one?
The other one is called The Front Runner.
Okay. Is this the one about Gary Hart?
That's correct.
Oh God! All right. No, I'm sorry. The trailer looks ridiculous, and I can't even imagine Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart. I can't even imagine it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. It's Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart in Jason Reitman's new film about the 1988 election season when Gary Hart was the high front runner over George H.W. Bush in the Republican primaries.
Right.
And the movie basically covers this three-week period where the scandal started to break and his lead crushed, and he was eventually out of the race. People don't remember this period in history. Gary Hart was caught sleeping with a staffer of his named Donna Rice, who was played by Sarah Paxton in the film, by the way.
Yeah, that's the only reason that I want to see it.
Yeah. you don't see the actual affair.
Yeah. But she's in it, and I love her. I love Sarah Paxton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it charts this whole thing where the movie wants to, seems to take the position that, this is where journalism started to go too far. That it was, there's a lot of talk in the movie about, how, this stuff wasn't investigated during the John F. Kennedy years and all this kind of stuff. And Alfred Molina plays Ben Bradley in the film. This movie is, taking chunks of much better movies, political movies, two in particular, one obviously being The Post, which is still fresh in our mind.
Yeah.
And the other one, so obviously that it wants to be, is Primary Color.
Yeah, that's the first thing that popped into my head when I saw the trailer was like, don't try.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I even invoked the name.
Yeah,
frankly, because this movie is garbage.
Yeah,
this movie is really bad. This is a movie that can't figure out what position it wants to take on the entire scandal. It's the kind of movie that is the movie that keeps telling you how great a president Gary Hart's going to be without actually giving you any insight into why we should believe that. It's the kind of movie, where they're interviewing Donna Rice, and twice in the movie she tells you she's magnum cum laude and that she didn't deserve this kind of stuff. And the press are just sneaking in the backyard and his bushes and stuff like that, and how dare you do, it's that kind of movie. I'm like, well, wait a minute. He got caught during.
Yeah.
This is one of the something that they, they found 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There are clearly a lot of debates to be had about all of this stuff, but this movie isn't interested in having any of them.
You know what's really hearing this, Eric, what's unbelievably disappointing is that this is his follow-up to Tully.
Yeah.
I mean, and Tully is such a great movie, I don't know.
Yeah, this might, Reitman, we might be thinking that this, my Rob Reiner argument, that maybe he needs good scripts.
Yeah.
And Diablo Cody gave him three good scripts.
Right.
And, Up in the Air, I don't think Thank You for Smoking is particularly good. I'm a big fan of Up in the Air. But some of his other movies, not so great.
I'm with you on that rundown entirely. I like Up in the Air. I don't love it. I like it. And the other ones, Thank You for Not Smoking, I didn't care for. And the other ones are not very good. But the Diablo Cody movies, all three of them are good.
Yeah, and this is a movie that could be very timely. It's a movie that has so many angles that it could connect with, with the current administration and all this kind of thing. But it's not interested in having those conversations. It's interested in, Reitman trying to do a Robert Altman-esque type movie. All the characters are talking over one another,
right,
and all the scenes and stuff like that, and the camera's moving all over the place, and it's just, you sit there just like, but you, there's nothing. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
It's a terrible film.
Yeah, it looks bad. I have to say, my first impression when I saw the trailer was no. So, right. Where do you want to go next?
Well, speaking of both rising stars and films that you weren't crazy about the trailer, let's go to A Star Is Born.
Okay. Bradley Cooper's the fourth version of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fourth version, 1937, 1954, and 1976.
Right.
And, the first question, obviously, is why do we need another version of this story? That's, you know, that's a pretty easy question to ask. You know, Bradley Cooper wanted to take this on as his directorial debut. You know, kind of interesting. You know, maybe you want to go in with something familiar and, you know, put your own spin on it. And it is Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga in the film. And, you know, people know what the story is.
Yeah.
Should by now. And I'll say, you know, so, you know, it's a movie that's divided into two halves, the rise and the fall. And, you know, the both of them are going in different directions.
Right.
And I will say that the first half of this movie, I think, is pretty terrific.
Yeah.
I think Cooper and Lady Gaga are both very good. You know, their performances are terrific throughout the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the songs are great in the movie. I think the songs are particularly good. I think that the second half, when it starts to get her rise, his downfall a little bit, there are some elements that don't quite compute. They try to do the whole, and I've seen this, and we've seen this for like two or three times at this festival alone, where the trope about how music producers try to turn great singers into poppy icons,
right,
kind of thing, and how that's somehow a bad thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
considering, you know, how one of your favorite artists of all time is Madonna.
Yeah.
And I know that's kind of your Lady Gaga, you have an issue with that,
right.
obviously.
Right.
But, you know, I think Madonna and Lady Gaga are two examples of how you can have a great poppy influence in your music and not feel like a sellout.
Right.
And you know, and that's one of the things that, you know, is kind of bothers me about the second half of the movie, which is just, I mean, it's not bad. It's just kind of like, oh, this kind of stuff could have been handled better. But it's a film that's going to be very well liked.
Yeah.
It
seems to me, though, that it seems to be closely aligned with the Barbara Streisand version from 76. It feels like he looks like Kris Kristofferson. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it seems mm-hmm. like that they're taking it from the 76 version mostly.
Yeah, and I, you know, when I first saw the trailer, and I, you know, the sort of the drawl that Bradley Cooper has for his character, and I thought he was doing Eddie Vedder throughout the movie, actually. And but actually, his brother in the movie is played by Sam Elliott, and apparently, he was developing his voice to be more like Sam Elliott.
Oh, I see.
And the Elliott is terrific in the movie too. There's a lot of, I mean, Dave Chappelle's in the film,
mm-hmm.
a lot of good people in this movie. Elliot is, you know, is really good in his scene, and it's a movie that a lot of people are going to like.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, people who are familiar with the old stories, it's a very old fashioned story. The Lady Gaga fans, obviously, Bradley Cooper's certainly got his share of fans. It's a crowd pleasing, sad movie.
Okay. All right.
I think you're going to see a lot of Oscars for it.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And it's co-written by Eric Roth, which is another interesting screenwriter. And Bradley Cooper co-wrote it
mm-hmm.
as well. So, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'll tell you what, the 76 version of A Star is Born is one of my mom's favorite movies of all time. Like, of all time. And every time we see the trailer for this movie, she's like, we have to see it. Like, she's very excited about it.
she will very much like it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, where do you want to go next?
Well, I guess since I just mentioned Oscars, I want to talk about a movie called Beautiful Boy.
Yeah, this is Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's based on a true story, a memoir, paramemoir, a couple memoirs, written by a writer from Rolling Stone, who's played by Steve Carell. And his son, Timothy Chalamet, is addicted to a number of different substances, but particularly crystal meth. And, you know, this is a story about, flat out, it's a story about addiction more than recovery. And, you know, we've seen so many countless movies, you know, broaching the subject, some great ones, some really melodramatic ones. But this one, to me, very few movies capture the sort of the feel, the sort of the helpless feel of addiction, not just by the person who's addicted, but by the people around them who love them and want to try to help them. And that's what this movie has, I think, going for it in spades. Because you know, a lot of the movie is told through the eyes of Steve Carell's character, who's just, you know, he so wants to do everything he can for his son, but it's, you know, he won't let him in a way,
yeah.
You know, and he wants to understand the addiction more than trying to cure it necessarily.
Yeah.
Because it knows it might not be something that can be cured, but maybe it can be controlled, stemmed off, and maybe if I understand it a little bit better, I'll be able to know what direction to take with it.
Right.
And that's what this movie, you know, has that feel to it. You know, I actually compared it in a different sort of way, actually, to Requiem for a Dream, because that movie, you know, is a horrific, tale of, you know, what it's like to be an addict.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, I think, you know, it's kind of like Requiem for a Dream for, you know, the person who's not addicted, mm-hmm. the person that just wants to help.
Right.
And, you know, Carell, I think, is really good in the film. And Chalamet is my God.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of performances where characters are strung out on drugs and things. And this one, there's also that helplessness feel, that you really get to feel that the need for it.
Yeah.
In his story. It's not just that, like, oh, I'm just going to do it because I want to get high, but that there's a need for it. Even when he's, you know, sober as hell, that there's going to be a moment where it you know, it's going to come close to a breakdown. And I like this movie, I think, a lot more than some people did, because I really had that feeling that it was taking the story of addiction in a way that we don't often see in film.
Okay. All right, that's called Beautiful Boy, and it will be in theaters. We'll be able to see it in October 12th.
So. Yeah.
All right, Eric, hang on. We'll come back in another quick set of reviews, okay?
Okay.
All right, Eric Childress is with us. We'll take a quick break here on WGN, and when we come back, a couple more reviews from Toronto, from the Toronto International Film Festival, right after this on WGN. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio Monday morning, and we're here every weekday morning, 1 to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich is the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. We're wrapping things up here with Eric Childress, who every year gives us live reports from the Toronto Film Festival. All right, Eric, where do you want to go next?
Okay. Well, I hate to end this with a couple of disappointments,
okay.
But that's the nature. And the next one is actually another story about addiction that I saw just yesterday as well. It's called Ben is Back.
Ben is Back.
And it's a new film from Peter Hedges, who did Pieces of April, wrote What's Eating Gilbert Grape, adapted About a Boy. So this is a very, very good writer. And his son, Lucas Hedges, is the star of this movie. He plays Ben, who comes back home. He's been in recovery for a couple of months, and he comes back home unexpectedly, leaves the treatment on a kind of a pass, and his whole family is surprised and horrified to see him. His mother, played by Julia Roberts, is very happy to see him, but her husband, played by Courtney B. Vance, and her daughter, played by Catherine Newton from Blockers, she's not so happy, because there have been some incidents over the last couple of holidays involving his addictions to painkillers and much worse. So there's this kind of an internal struggle going on about whether or not he's welcome back for this particular Christmas. The first half of the movie is the family coming to terms with that, and I think that's when the film is at its best. Not great. I think Beautiful Boy does a lot of this stuff better. There's a little bit more speechifying and some melodramatic stuff going on the first half, but it actually gets up to a point where, about halfway through the movie, I think it actually reaches an actual climax to the story. I'm just like, well, that's a really nice moment, but we're only halfway through, and the second half of the movie actually turns into this, like, crime plot involving people from his past that he owes money to that might be now terrorizing his family, and his efforts to put a stop to that, and it leads to basically Julia Roberts chasing him down for the last half of the movie, and that's when the movie just gets completely convoluted, and I couldn't really go along with the story anymore. So the first half of the movie, it was on the right track, and then by the second half, I was just like, where are you going with this? And it just leads to a place, to a lot of places that I thought were very false.
Yeah.
Where, again, Beautiful Boy, I thought, hit a lot of those truths a lot harder.
Okay. I really loved, as you know, I loved Pieces of April. That movie.
Yeah,
I adore that movie. So this is kind of disappointing. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, we got time for one more. What do you want to get to next?
Okay. One more is a new film from Joel Edgerton, actor and writer, and he also co-stars in the movie. It's called Boy Erased.
Okay.
And it also stars Lucas Hedges.
Wow.
As the boy in the film, as a gay, closeted gay teenager whose father is Russell Crowe. He's a pastor, and his mother is played by Nicole Kidman. And as the movie opens, he's being placed into a center that specializes in gay conversion therapy.
Well, we already had that. We already had the Chloe Grace Moretz movie.
Yes. Miseducation of Cameron Post.
Right, right.
Yeah. We have. So this is the second gay conversion movie of the year. I really hate it. That's the Cameron Post film for a variety of reasons. It's actually one of the worst films of the year, frankly.
Yeah.
And this film is not much better. I don't know why it's so hard to display the insidiousness of this particular brand of therapy on screen. I don't know if they're afraid to go the full route with this, but this is a movie that, again, is very clumsy. It's very sort of confused about what direction it wants to take. And sometimes I was even confused whether or not it was going in a straightforward line at times. Because the movie jumps around with him in college, and then he's home, and then he's in the therapy, and it's voluntary, so that he's getting driven to it and whatnot. So there's so many things about the movie that could have been handled much better. Joel Edgerton plays the leader of this therapy group,
right?
And the movie has the weirdest title credits I've seen in some time. You're watching the credits and it says with Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers,
right?
With Flea just pops up on the screen, and he plays one of the guys in one of the cohorts of the therapy group.
Yeah,
he plays the real jerk.
Well, sure.
In this group, I can't understand why it's such an easy target. It should be so easy to make people, you know, right thinking people feel something during, you know, a movie like this,
right?
And I think, you know, Russell Crowe gets to do some good stuff towards the end of the movie. Hedges is fine. I think he's better in Ben is Back, frankly. And I think Nicole Kidman's character is incredibly underwritten. You know, she plays, you know, basically the mom that is confused about the whole situation, but then grows to be the right-thinking one in the family.
Right.
And that arc is not very well explored and feels very cliched. I was really looking forward to this because I really wanted to see a movie tackle the subject with some real gravitas, and this one just isn't it.
Okay. That's Boy Erased. It opens November 2nd. All right. Well, Eric, you're there until Thursday, and then we'll get another full report. We'll get another full report a week from this morning.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, man. Have fun.
Thanks a lot.
All right. See you later. There you go. Eric Childress giving us exclusive reviews of movies at the Toronto International Film Festival. All right. Let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Okay, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Here until 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. My main man, Steve Cochran, at 6 for your morning drive. We're here every weekday morning. Your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means a little bit later on, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And that's coming up, so stay tuned for that. So the NFL season obviously kicked off this weekend. And, Dan, you're doing well on your fantasy league.
Yes, I am the lead. Good chance of winning tomorrow.
Oh, good for you, man.
Thank you.
Good for you. So we thought we would tell you about how all 32 NFL teams got their names. Now, Dan, how many of these did you know?
I knew probably maybe 5-8 of them.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Vic, do you know any of the origin stories behind some of the NFL team names?
I know some backstories to teams that have moved from one city to another, but yeah. I can't think of any that I know right off the top of my head.
Let me start with the Bears. I think we should, don't we all kind of know where this came from?
It is one of the more legendary slash logical ones.
Yeah. In 1921, the Decatur Staleys, a charter member of the American Football Professional Football Association, moved to Chicago and kept their nickname, a nod to the team's sponsor, the Staley Starch Company. I love that the that the mascot of the Chicago Bears is named after a starch company. I think that's pretty fantastic. So when star player George Halas purchased the team the following year, he decided to change the nickname. The Chicago played its home games at Wrigley Field, which is the home of the Chicago of the baseball Cubs, and Halas opted to stick with the theme. So it is related to the Cubs. So, except the Cubs are all cute, and the Bears are ready to kill. So that one I knew about. I really didn't know that Staley was a starch company. I knew that they were called the Staleys.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
And I mean, I knew it had to be a name of, you know, like whoever owned it, you know, whoever owned them or what the nickname was. But now to come full circle that the mascot is named after a starch company, that kind of cracks me up. Staley's a good mascot, though.
He is, yes.
Yeah, he's great. Speaking of mascots, I just shared a video on my Facebook page of JoJo's birthday party from a couple of months ago.
Oh, I did not know it was 1 year anniversary.
Yeah, he had 1 year, and they had a big birthday party at Brookfield Zoo. And they put together a video of JoJo acting like a lunatic, inviting people to his birthday party and then running around. JoJo, by the way, JoJo is the mascot for Jewel Osco. And he rules. He's got one eye, and it's big. All right. Arizona Cardinals. The franchise began play in Chicago in 1898 before moving to St. Louis in 1960 and Arizona in 1988. Team owner Chris O'Brien purchased used and faded maroon jerseys from the University of Chicago in 1901 and dubbed the color of the squad's new outfits Cardinal Red, and the nickname was born. That's really kind of a funny story. Yeah, we got these old, used, faded maroon jerseys from the University of Chicago. Arizona Cardinals. Now, when the franchise, when they played in Chicago, were they the Cardinals?
I do not believe so.
And then, no, because that was 1898. Now, when they moved to St. Louis, they weren't the Cardinals either, were they? They weren't the St. Louis Cardinals football team, were they?
They might have been by that point. I'm trying to pull up their Wikipedia here.
Oh, okay. And when they moved to Arizona, then they became the Cardinals again. So,
well, they were. I know when I was like in high school, they were the St. Louis Cardinals.
They were. So they had a
99% sure
a football team and a baseball team named the Cardinals in St. Louis.
Yeah, I'm almost positive.
They were
the same. I'm almost positive.
You guys would know better than me. I don't follow the football. I just think, are there any other sports teams in cities that have the same name that are different sports?
It comes up a few times on this list that they ended up having to change their names because there was a baseball team or another team, you know, in the same area.
Mm. All right. The Atlanta Falcons, shortly after insurance executive Rankin Smith brought professional football to Atlanta, a local radio station sponsored a contest to name the team. While several fans submitted the nickname Falcons, school teacher Julia Elliott of nearby Griffin was declared the winner of the contest for the reason she provided. The Falcon is proud and dignified with great courage and fight, she wrote. It never drops its prey. It is deadly and has great sporting tradition. Elliott won 4 season tickets for 3 years and a football autographed by the entire 1966 inaugural team. Well, we all know this one, the Baltimore Ravens. That's an obvious one.
There's another obvious one.
What? Which one is that?
The Cowboys.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking after I told you no. Oh, that's pretty. You know, that's kind of a given.
Yeah, it is. I remember, you know, hoping that when the Ravens came into being, I remember I was hoping that their logo would somehow, like, because Edgar Allan Poe is my favorite writer of all time, and I was hoping they would somehow have his face on the on the helmet. I was hoping that it would be Edgar Allan Poe's face. But no, that's not true. But Ravens is a reference to Edgar Allan Poe's famous poem. It beat out Americans and Marauders in a contest conducted by the Baltimore Sun. Poe died and is buried in Baltimore. The Marauders and the Americans. Okay. How about this? Buffalo Bills. The Bills nickname was suggested as part of a fan contest in 1947 to rename Buffalo's All-American Football Conference team, which was originally known as the Bisons. The Bills nickname referenced frontiersman Buffalo Bill Cody and was selected over Bullets, Nickels, and Blue Devils. Nickels? Oh, because of the Buffalo Nickel. Oh, I see. All right. It helped that the team was owned by President of Frontier Oil, James Brule. So they went with Bills. Buffalo was without a team from 1950 to 59 when owner Ralph Wilson acquired a franchise in the AFL. Wilson solicited potential nicknames from fans for his new franchise and ultimately chose Bills in an homage to the city's defunct AAFC team. That would have been, I thought that would be pretty funny if they were the Nickels. What would their mascot be? Like a guy in a giant nickel costume? With his arms sticking out of the sides.
What if they had five mascots and they were all pennies? Something like that.
Oh man. Carolina Panthers. Panthers team president Mark Richardson, the son of team owner Jerry Richardson, chose the Panthers nickname because, quote, it's a name our family thought signifies what we think a proud team should be. Powerful, sleek, and strong. How about that? Oh, we got more information on the Cardinals, Dan? Here's Don on WGN. Hi, Don.
Yeah. My stepfather's father played football for the Illinois Cardinals in 1903. His name was Ensweiler.
Uh-huh.
They were from the South Side. They had the original franchise for the NFL in Chicago.
They did? Oh, okay.
And they invited the Bears to move to Chicago to make more money.
I see. Okay.
And there's a whole website. Some kids got one up with all the pictures of them. And it's just Illinois Cardinals, Chicago Cardinals. And it'll show you the history on it.
Okay. All right. Going back in time there. Yeah. All right, Don.
Yeah,
thank you, sir.
They've been around for quite a while.
Yeah. Very cool. Thank you, Don.
Take it easy.
All right. So the Bears, 1921 is when they moved to Chicago. So, yeah. How about this? Cincinnati Bengals, team owner, general manager, and head coach Paul Brown nicknamed Cincinnati's AFL expansion franchise the Bengals in 1968 in honor of the football team nicknamed the Bengals that played in the city from 37 to 42. So the Bengals were around before. How about the Cleveland? But hey, did the Browns actually win yesterday?
No, They did, however, snap their 17-game losing streak, but they tied.
Oh, they wait.
They're still winless.
Wait a minute. There are ties in the NFL?
Now, for ties, that, you'll have to ask Dan. I think he'll be able to explain it a little better, but yes, there are.
How is that a thing now?
So they do not play until they have a set of rules, but it's a 10-minute overtime period, and at the end of that 10 minutes, if nobody has scored within these set of rules, because you have to score 6 basically in order to win the game. They instituted this rule a couple of years ago because everybody would just win the coin toss, go 30 yards and kick a field goal, and that would be the end of the game. So to make it more even, they basically instituted a rule where it was either you get the first team that wins a coin flip has to go and get six, or if they don't, if they get three, the other team gets the ball back and have a chance to meet it up. In this case, the Browns and the Steelers did not do anything in their overtime period, and so at the end of the 10-minute overtime, it ended, and that was it.
Is this the first time they've had a tie? I mean, you said it was 2 years, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but this is not the first tie. There's been two or three every year since.
I think it was pretty dramatic, too. I read that somebody blocked the field goal.
A Steeler blocked the field goal in the last seconds.
You know, I can just picture the Browns, like, praying before the game, God, please just don't let us lose. And then later praying, you know, maybe I should have been a little more specific.
And the Browns had come back from 14 down. They played really well in the second half and then lost it.
They tied.
But they didn't lose.
No, but they didn't lose.
Because I think Bud Light has fridges. Locked up around Cleveland for when they win, and when they will unlock the fridges so people can have the beer.
We were talking about that as a promotion. And saying that there are definitely not enough beers in that stadium to satisfy all the Cleveland fans who are going to want. I mean, Cleveland, known as a city for bad beer promotions at sporting events, 10-cent beer night. We all remember how legendary that was. Oh man, I feel bad for the Browns fans. Well, they didn't lose, so, but still. And if it was in that kind of dramatic fashion with a blocked field goal, I have friends from Cleveland. I guess I was sleeping during that game, so I guess I didn't check out the news feed of my friends from Cleveland who were probably going nuts. All right. Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk more about, but what we'll tell you first of all when we come back, how the Cleveland Browns got their name. Not one of the best names in sports, I don't think. So let's take a break here on WGN. Welcome back, everyone. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about some rock and roll pioneers, some really true pioneers as well. But right now, you know, the NFL season kicked off this weekend, and we're telling you the origins of the names of the NFL teams. And some of them are pretty funny, and some of them are pretty interesting. And we were just at the Cleveland Browns. And before the break, we were discussing, Dan and Vic and I were discussing, that the Browns tied today. Is there, I'm sure you're not familiar with the Browns' full schedule, but has anybody said whether they have a tough schedule or not this year?
I don't know their schedule, but there's a lot of excitement about the team.
Is there?
Yeah, they have made significant moves to try to become better, and a lot of people think that they will get a win this year. That's for sure, and they will get multiple wins. So
okay. Anyway, here's their name. There is some debate about whether Cleveland's professional football franchise was named after its first coach and general manager, Paul Brown, or after boxer Joe Louis, who was nicknamed the Brown Bomber. There's two conflicting reasons, two conflicting stories there. One of the other obvious ones that Vic was mentioning a little bit earlier is the Dallas Cowboys. The Cowboys, who began play in the NFL in 1960, were originally going to be nicknamed the Steers. The team's general manager, Texas E. Stram. The guy's name was Texas? Come on, really? The guy who owned the Dallas football team, his general manager was Texas. Okay, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. That's like if the owner of the Bears was named Grizzly. That would be all right. Grizzly Adams was the owner of the Bears. So Texas E. Schramm decided that having a castrated bovine as a mascot might subject the team to ridicule, so he decided to go with Rangers instead. But fearing that people would confuse the football team with the local minor league baseball team nicknamed the Rangers, Schramm finally changed the nickname to Cowboys shortly after the season began. That's one of the best stories, man. That's one of the best ones. with having a castrated bovine as a mascot. The guy in a mascot costume would come on and go, ah, oh, and clutch his crotch while he's running around in the seats. Texas E. Schramm. All right, Denver Broncos. Denver was a charter member of the AFL in 1960, and Broncos, which was submitted along with a 25-word essay by Ward M. Vining. Man, some great names in these things, man. Ward M. Vining? Used to hang out with Texas E. Schramm. Let's see. He was the winning entry among 162 fans who responded in a Name the Team contest. So they had a lot of contests for naming teams.
They did, yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of cool. The Detroit Lions. The nickname was likely derived from Detroit's established baseball team, the Tigers, who won 101 games in the AL pennant that year. As the team explained it, the lion is the monarch of the jungle, and we hope to be the monarch of the league. Oh. Oh. Green Bay Packers, who defeated the Chicago Bears last night. How many times did they play the Packers this year? Three times? Twice?
Twice.
Twice. And it's here next time, right?
Regular season.
Oh, okay. All right. Green Bay Packers. Team founder Earl Curly Lambeau, his employer, the Indian Packing Company, sponsored Green Bay's football team and provided equipment and access to the field. The Indian Packing Company became the Acme Packing Company and later folded, but the nickname stuck. I knew that one. I mean, as you do, even if you're a casual football watcher like I am, you know, you know where the Packers got their name from because it's such a strange name, you know? Boy, people have fun making fun of that name, don't they? There's so many ways that you can go, so many different avenues that you can go to make fun of the name. and people go there. Cub fan, Bear fans go there. All right, how about this? The Houston Texans. Houston owner Bob McNair chose Texans over Apollos and Stallions. And that's it. That's the only explanation that they have. The boss said, I don't want Apollos, I don't want Stallions, we're Texans. All right. Let's take a break. If you guys want to jump in here with any comments or questions, it's 312-981-7200. If you guys have any origin stories for nicknames of any sports teams, 312-981-7200. If you have a favorite one, we would love to hear from you. So you can talk or text us right now with where the nicknames and names from sports teams came from. We're specifically talking about the NFL, but we can expand it to other sports as well. But we're specifically talking about the NFL because it kicked off this weekend. All right. Let's take a quick break. We got the news coming up next. And then we'll get back to more of the team nicknames. Some great stories. Texas E. Schramm. I think he's my new hero. All right. News is up next. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. It's a jokey time. And more. We're going to be talking about some legendary rock and roll pioneers in just a little bit. And we also have we're talking about some NFL team names and some of the history and stories behind them. If you guys want to jump in with your favorite sort of team naming history stories, 312-981-7200. This list that we're talking about, the stories are about NFL teams, and doing this because the NFL kicked off. The new season started this weekend, and so we thought it would be appropriate to talk about that. But if you have any other special nickname stories that you like, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right, let's get back to it. Indianapolis Colts. The Baltimore Colts, a member of the All-America Football Conference from 1947 and 1950, was named in honor of the region's history of horse breeding. The name remained when a new franchise began to play in 1953, and then after the team relocated in Indianapolis in 1984. Yeah, that's because there's no, I mean, but there's no horse breeding in Indianapolis, is there? That's pretty funny when the nickname from a different part of the country sticks. Like, there are no Colts in Indianapolis, are there, Dan? They're not known for that. but they have horse breeding in Baltimore. So, you know, it's one of my favorite. You ever seen the movie Injustice for All, where Al Pacino's screaming, "You're out of order, and I'm out of order"?
I have not.
Okay, it's a great movie. It really is a great movie. It's one of my favorites, in fact. It's completely over the top. Pacino, you know, he's not as bad as he was later in his career, but that was kind of the first. That was like the he jimmied the lock on the screaming door. You know, kicked it wide open for Son of a Woman. You know what I mean? But, like, kind of jimmied that lock with Injustice for All. He screams pretty good in that movie. But it takes place in Baltimore. The movie takes place in Baltimore. And he plays a lawyer who is defending a judge played by John Forsythe, Charlie, of Charlie's Angels fame. And Dynasty. Everybody knows him from Dynasty. Blake Carrington. So, anyway, he defends this judge on a sexual, like a rape charge. And the reason why he was asked to defend him is because they have a really bad relationship, like they hate each other. And so it was like a political move for the judge and his strategists to get Al Pacino, because if Al Pacino is going to defend him, then he's got to be innocent. And that's basically what the movie's about. And it takes place within the law world of Baltimore. And at one point, Jeffrey Tambor's in it with hair. Well, not the whole movie. He shaves his head at one point because he goes insane and starts throwing plates down a hallway. Because what happens is he's a defense attorney, too. And he gets this murderer off on a technicality. So, like, brilliant defense. He gets this guy off, and he was guilty. The guy was a killer, and he was guilty. He gets set out on the street, and then he kills a bunch of kids. And so Tambor has a nervous breakdown because he's responsible for getting this guy off on this murder charge. And it was one of these, one of the things about the movie is that it's like, what is it like to be a defense attorney? Even if you know that this guy's guilty, you know, what do you do? So he has a meltdown. So anyway, Tambor's in. At the beginning of the movie, Tambor's got this guy that he's bringing up on a, like a burglary charge or something. And Forsythe is the judge, and he's a real strict judge, a real jerk. He goes, you've brought before me, you've been brought before this court many times, haven't you? And his client, the guy that is Tambor's client, says, yeah, yes, Your Honor, yes, I have. And he's like, for what do you got? You got attempted rape, burglary, arson? What's the matter? Don't you know what you want to be when you grow up? And then he's like, shakes his head, and he says, his response is, does the client have anything else to say? Does the defendant have anything else to say? And he looks over at Tambor, and Tambor shakes his head. No, don't say anything. Just shut up. Don't say anything. He goes, yes, Your Honor. Long pause. And he goes, I'm a loyal Colts fan. It's one of my favorite lines in the entire movie. And then he throws the book at him. Like the worst possible, you know, like he goes. Then as they're walking out, Tambor is walking out with him. And his bail is revoked, and he has to, you know, he's going to be walking out, and they're going to throw him back in the clink. And as they're walking out, Jeffrey Tambor goes, nice move, Colts fan, like I need that right now. Yes, sir, Your Honor, I'm a loyal Colts fan. All right, Jacksonville Jaguars. The Jaguars nickname was selected through another fan contest in 1991. While Jaguars aren't native to Jacksonville, the oldest living Jaguar in North America is housed at the Jacksonville Zoo. So they're named after, like, some old jaguar is, like, going, oh, man, I'm 107 years old. That's a good story. The Kansas City Chiefs. Owner Lamar Hunt said the name was locally important because Native Americans had once lived in the area. Hunt may have also been swayed by Kansas City Mayor H. Roe Bartle, whose nickname was the Chief. Bartle helped lure the team to Kansas City by promising Hunt that the city would meet certain attendance thresholds. H. Roe Bartle, another great name. The Los Angeles Chargers. Team owner Baron Hilton sponsored a Name the Team contest and promised a trip to Mexico City to the winner in 1960. Gerald Courtney submitted Chargers, and Hilton reportedly liked the name so much that he didn't open another letter. That's fair. Nice contest. Nice way to run a contest, Baron. According to one story, Hilton liked the name in part for its affiliation with his new carte blanche credit card. Because you charge with the credit card, see? There's a charge. The owner also told reporters that he found he was fond of the charge bugle cry played in the Los Angeles Coliseum. All right. How about the Los Angeles Rams? Principal owner Homer Marshman. What? Wow. And general manager Damon Buzz Wetzel. These can't be real.
I mean, if you think about it, it's the 10s and the 20s, so I didn't have anything better to do than name their kids weird stuff.
Homer Marshman and Damon Buzz Wetzel chose the nickname because Wetzel's favorite football team had always been the Fordham Rams. Fordham, Vince Lombardi's alma mater, was a powerhouse at the time. Oh, okay. Miami Dolphins. And you know the proudest moment in Miami Dolphins history? Ace Ventura. Their association with Ace Ventura. name the team contest drew 20,000 entries and resulted in the nickname for the Miami franchise that entered the AFL as an expansion team in 1966. Wow, they've only been around since 66? The Dolphins? Why did I think they had a longer history? They just feel like a team that had a longer history.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, because of the 16-0, and they get talked about a lot.
Yeah. Miami owner Joe Robbie was fond of the winning nickname because, as he put it, the Dolphin is one of the fastest and smartest creatures in the sea. Yeah, but you guys aren't in the sea. You're on a football field. Yeah, Dolphins. Minnesota Vikings. According to the Vikings website, Burt Rose, see, now there's a normal name, Burt Rose. Minnesota's general manager, when it joined in the NFL in 1961, recommended the nickname to the team's board of directors because it represented both an aggressive person with the will to win and the Nordic tradition of the northern Midwest. Yeah, that's a good name. Yeah, good name. Let's see. New England Patriots. 74 fans suggested Patriots in the Name the Team contest that was conducted by management, the management of Boston's original AFL franchise in 1960. Pat Patriot, the cartoon of a Minuteman preparing to snap a football drawn by Boston Globe's Phil Bissell, was chosen as the team's logo soon after. His name is Pat? I didn't know his name was Pat. I mean, I know the nickname of the Patriots is the Pats, but I didn't know their mascot was Pat Patriot. I didn't know that. I just thought he was just some Patriot, but it's Pat, the Patriot.
I do love when they use the name.
When they use the name?
When, like you know, it's the same name as the...
What's the mascot for the Clark, right?
Clark, correct.
Okay. You remember when they first announced the mascot and people were fuming because they were spending money on a mascot and not because the team was they sucked at that time. They were in that transition, that weird Theo transition. By the way, I hung out with Theo Epstein over the weekend.
Name dropper.
He was at Buffalo Tom, hung out with Theo Epstein, and I was there the moment that Bryce Harper hit the home run and he had his phone. He did not have kind words to say about Bryce Harper. He's a cool dude, man. I've met him a couple of times, and he's a very, very cool dude. And he got on stage with Buffalo Tom. He plays guitar. He got on stage with Buffalo Tom, and they covered the Who song, The Seeker. It was a jam.
Very nice. Right?
And Dag Juhlin came on stage and played guitar, too, and then I talked to him for, like, a long time. Dag's a big fan of this show. I wasn't aware of that.
That's awesome.
He's a really big fan of this show, and it made that abundantly clear Saturday night. I was beside myself. I was thrilled. I was like, thank you, man. Guy's a radio guy himself. Works with Dahl.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. And a legend. I mean, Poi Dog Pondering?
Sure.
Been part of the Chicago music scene for a long time. Very cool guy. So anyway, when Clark first made his little debut and people were upset because, you know, why don't you spend money on pitching instead of a bear, a bear costume? Do you remember when the image of Clark was messed with?
Yes.
And it ended up over the shoulders of some anchors on TV?
Right, right.
They put genitalia on Clark.
Because Clark doesn't wear pants.
Yeah, like many cartoon characters and mascots, they sans pants. But someone put like genitalia on it, and it made it several TV stations.
Yep.
It wasn't just like one mistake. How do you not see that?
Right. Some intern.
Yeah.
Just like, hey, get us a picture of Clark. All right.
Yeah. And he goes online and gets the one with the genitalia. The
first one that pops up in Google in my church.
Oh, man. That was funny. That was pretty funny. Peter in Decatur sends in some a story here. Staley was more than a starch company. It was a corn and soybean processing company. One of the many products from corn and was corn starch, but there are many others. One small example is the corn to make light beer. I worked at A.C. Staley's. Wow. Peter worked at Staley's. All right. Canadian Bill says the Montreal Canadiens are known as the Habs. I know that one. In the 20s, there were two teams in the Montreal, the Canadiens and the Maroons. The Canadiens were a working-class team, and the Maroons made fun of them because there is a pea soup in Quebec called Habitat Soup. It was eaten by the working class. The Maroons called them the Habitants, and that's the Canadiens were proud of that, and they adopted the nickname. I knew that story. We know why it's hockey. That's why it's a sport that I actually follow. I remember hearing someone refer to them as the Habs years ago, and I was like, Habs? What the hell? And that's how I got the story. I love that, though. I love that. It's one of my favorite nicknames.
That is cool.
Yeah. All right. Hey, we're going to break here. Get a little weather forecast for you here. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. What's going on? We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because that's what we do on Monday. We hear jokes. Coming up at 5 is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and at 6, Steve Cochran with your morning drive. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. That's all coming up. So we have been talking about the stories behind some of these names of the NFL teams have. Some of them are really fun, and we've come across some interesting stories and some very interesting and weird names to go along with these stories. And we thought we would talk about how the NFL franchises got their names because it's football season, just started. So we got a couple of phone calls coming in. If you want to text or call us with your stories or comments, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Here's Chris on WGN. Hi, Chris.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Nick, are you old enough to remember a toy called the Super Bowl?
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Lamar Hunt and the Kansas City Chiefs are trying to come up with a name for the Super Bowl. And his little daughter was playing with a Super Bowl.
Oh, and that's how they got the name from the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. See that? Your daughter was playing with a Super Bowl, and they came up with Super Bowl.
Yeah. Oh. And the Portage Lake Flyers were the first professional hockey team in the United States. That's pre-NFL.
NHL, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's great. Thank you, Chris.
You bet.
Okay. Yeah, the old suit. You ever have a Super Bowl, Dan, when you were a kid?
I mean, they're really bouncy ones, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think bounces like 500
sure.
feet into the air.
Yeah.
I used to like to bounce it in the room. Bang all over the wall, maybe go through a window. Or, of course, gun it at my friend's face.
Right, right.
Which is, you know.
Was that before or after smacking him with the hot tracks?
With the hot wheel tracks? Usually at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. We loved it. We really did have fun playing when we were kids in the 70s. It was so much fun. The injuries were great. Okay, New Orleans Saints. New Orleans was awarded an NFL franchise on All Saints Day, November 1st, 1966. The nickname, chosen by owner John Meekham, was a nod to the city's jazz heritage and taken from the popular song When the Saints Go Marching In. I knew that one. That's an obvious one, though, of course.
Yeah.
New York Giants. New York owner Tim Morrow borrowed the Giants nickname from John McGraw's National League Baseball team, a common practice by football teams during the era when baseball was the nation's preeminent team sport. The New York Jets. According to a contemporary New York Times story, the franchise considered calling itself the Dodgers, but nixed the idea after Major League Baseball didn't like it. Gotham's also got some consideration, but the team didn't like the idea of having it short to Goths because they weren't nice people. And they would have to come out in black makeup, right? Black eyeliner and lipstick. Be part of the uniform.
Right.
And they would come out to the field to the Cure. And here are your New York Goths. You hear Disintegration playing as they take the field. The last finalist to fall was the New York Burrows, a pun on the city's burrows. The team worried about that opposing fans would make the Burrows connection and derisively call the squad the Jackasses. Eventually, the team became the Jets since it was going to play in Shea Stadium, which was close to LaGuardia. Okay. Oakland Raiders. Chet Soda. Oakland's first general manager sponsored a Name the Team contest in 1960. Helen H. Davis, an Oakland policewoman, submitted the winning entry, Seniors, and was rewarded with a trip to the Bahamas. The nickname, an allusion to the old Spanish settlers of Northern California, was ridiculed for weeks to follow, and fans also claimed that the contest was fixed. Scotty Sterling, a sports writer for the Oakland Tribune, would later become the team's general manager, provided another reason to abandon the nickname. That's no good, he said. We don't have the accent mark for the N in our headline type. Responding to backlash, Soda and the team's other investors decided that they would change the team's nickname to the Raiders, which was a finalist in the contest along with Lakers. Philadelphia Eagles, 1933, Burt Bell and Lud Ray purchased the bankrupt Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. The new owners renamed the team the Eagles in honor of the symbol of the National Recovery Act, which was part of President D. Roosevelt's New Deal. Pittsburgh Steelers, well, this is another obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Santoni, who worked in a mill for Pittsburgh Steel, was one of the several fans who suggested Steelers. Santoni received a pair of season tickets, which he would renew every year until his death in 2003. Oh. San Francisco 49ers. 49ers, who began to play in the All-American Football Conference in 1946, were named after the settlers who ventured to San Francisco during the Gold Rush of 1849. I knew that one, too. By the way, Scott Oaken's most hated football team.
Really?
Hates him. Hates him. Hates every good quarterback that ever played for him. Hates him. I'm not sure where the hate, and he still hates the 49ers, and I'm not sure where that comes from. He hates them more than the Packers.
Wow.
I know, man. I don't get it. Seattle Seahawks. Our new name suggests aggressiveness, reflects our soaring Northwest heritage, and belongs to no other major team, Seattle general manager John Thompson said. The Seahawks helmet design is a stylized head of a fish-eating hawk of the Northwest. Tampa Bay Buccaneers, a panel of local sports writers and representatives from the NFL expansion team, including owner Hugh F. Culverhouse, chose Buccaneers from an original list of more than 400 names in 1975. The nickname, which is a popular choice among fans in the Name the Team contest, was a nod to the pirates who raided Florida's coasts in the 17th century. Oh, it's okay. It's a nod to the people that raided your coast.
Right.
Tennessee Titans. After relocating from Houston to Tennessee in 1995, the team played two seasons as the Oilers before owner Bud Adams held a statewide contest to rename the team. Titans were chosen over other nicknames such as Tornadoes, Copperheads, South Stars, and Wranglers. I like South Stars. That's pretty cool. We wanted a new nickname to reflect strength, leadership, and heroic qualities. And then finally, the Washington Redskins. This is 1 year after acquiring an NFL franchise in Boston, George Preston Marshall changed the team's nickname from Braves to Redskins. According to most accounts, the nickname was meant to honor head coach and Native American William Henry Lone Star Dietz. There's some question whether Dietz was a Native American at all. The Redskins kept their controversial nickname when they relocated to Washington, D.C. in 1937. So there you go.
Keith in Kansas texts in, Wichita is in the process of making room for a AAA affiliate of the Miami Marlins, presently known as the New Orleans Baby Cakes. I hope the name is changed once they get to town.
Well, it's a famous thing, though. You know? Get the cake and there's a baby in it.
Yeah. I remember we did a segment about, you know, mascots.
Yeah.
And one of the lists was the scariest mascots of all time.
Yeah.
And one of them was... New Orleans baby from the cakes.
It's terrifying.
Oh my gosh.
It's terrifying. If you've not seen that, I think it's their basketball team.
That
right?
sounds right.
But yeah, it's like the little baby that you get inside the cake. But it was giant. It's like a, it's terrifying. I mean, even me, I love mascots, and I love weird looking mascots, crazy looking mascots, but that's just creepy. Just creepy. So, all right.
Well, and that, the New Orleans thing reminds me of one of the funniest nickname stories. It's the Utah Jazz. A lot of people right. don't know why, but it was, they started in New Orleans.
Right.
And moved to Utah. That's why they just kept the name.
Yeah.
But when New Orleans got the new team, and now they're the Pelicans, but one of the names they considered was the Chupacabras, the New Orleans Chupacabras.
That would be a hell of a mascot.
Would, yeah, I know. That would, you know, steal the fear yeah. of everybody in the league.
Oh, yeah. All right. All right. Well, there you go. We're going to take a break here. We've got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about some legendary rock and roll pioneers. And then a little bit later on, even more, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. That's all right here on 720 WGN. The news is coming up in, just about 8 seconds. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, high above downtown Chicago here. We're here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. Here every weekday morning, 1 to 5. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We do that every Monday. 312-981-7200 is our phone number for talk and text if you want to jump in here at any time. So we've got the essential rock and roll pioneers. Now, these are the we're talking, like I'm saying, pioneers. These are the originators, the ones that that set the table for everybody else to follow. And Pooper Clover is a website that narrowed it down to 20 essential rock and roll pioneers. Now, who do you think should be mentioned among these names? Because I'm looking at the list, and they all make sense to me. They all absolutely make sense to me. So, and we're talking about the originators, the pioneers. Who do you think should be part of the Rock and Roll Pioneer Club, the Essential Rock and Roll Pioneer Club? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Let's mention first Buddy Holly. Rock's first true singer-songwriter, Holly wrote and performed songs with his backing band, The Crickets, that remain as fresh and potent today as when he recorded them more than a half century ago. With his sweet country-tinged falsetto, trademark hiccup and Fender Stratocaster, and hits ranging from That'll Be the Day to Not Fade Away, the skinny Texan with horn-rimmed glasses inspired everyone from the Beatles to the Stones to Dylan and Clapton. Fortunately, Holly was killed in a plane crash at the age of 22 on February 3rd, 1959, also known as the day the music died. And played by Gary Busey. It's an odd choice because Gary Busey's a big dude. Buddy Holly was a skinny guy. He's terrific in the movie. Gary Busey's really good. He's not, to be fair, he's not quite as big in 1978 as Buddy Holly as he has gotten. I'm talking physically. But he was still like, yeah. But he's good in the movie. You ever see the Buddy Holly story?
Just bits and pieces of it.
Yeah, it's really good. He's terrific in it. He got nominated for an Academy Award.
By the way, Trucker Rich checked in a few minutes ago when Rookie of the Year was on the TV over the weekend, and he's just looking at it, he's like, he looks pretty hungover in this scene. He bet he was with DiGilio the night before, and he kept looking for the mustache to kind of like fall off.
For those of you who don't know, Gary Busey is in this movie called Rookie of the Year. He plays a pitcher for the Chicago Cubs, and I hung out with him for a week while he was filming in 1992. It was fall of 1992. And, yeah, and he did not have the mustache in that movie. If you watch Rookie of the Year, that mustache is fake. That is not a real mustache. All right. Elvis Presley, obviously, is next here. It all began on July 5th, 1954, when 19-year-old Elvis paid a visit to producer Sam Phillips' Sun Studios in Memphis to record a few Bing Crosby ballads. Phillips was underwhelmed. Then, just to let the team during a break, Elvis let it rip. He began wailing away on bluesman Arthur Big Boy Crudup's That's All Right Mama, with session men Scotty Moore and Bill Black joining in on the fun. What are you doing? Phillips asked, suddenly impressed. None of them had an answer. Certainly not Elvis, but it was rock and roll. I would love to hear the tapes of the Bing Crosby ballads that Elvis sang. Here we go, Little Richard. He predated Elvis. His first recordings came out in the early 50s. But Richard Penniman, also known as Little Richard, was a flamboyant black man who sang quote-unquote voodoo music, the kind of stuff that scared most white folk. Then, in 1955, Little Richard released a cleaned-up version of Tutti Frutti, a raunchy song he'd been improvising in clubs, and it became a crossover hit, followed by such classic rock and roll songs as Long Tall Sally, Slippin' and Slidin', and Rip It Up. Little Richard's early stage performances were positively wild until 1958, when he temporarily gave up music. He helped invent and become a traveling preacher. Chuck Berry. Well, I mean, please. Hey, by the way, speaking of Chuck Berry, Bill told this great story. Bill Janovitz of Buffalo Tom told this great story Saturday night when we were chatting. His favorite band, Bill's favorite band of the Stones, and one of his absolute idols is Keith Richards. And so, you know, we were just kind of like sitting around after the show, and somebody said, "Do you ever meet anybody from the Stones?" He said, I met Keith Richards. It was like his hero. Because, you know, Bill's written a book about the Stones. He wrote a book called Rocks Off, and it's ridiculous how much he loves the Stones. So anyway, he was telling the story that they were there, that a whole bunch of people were there, and they were there to honor Chuck Berry. And so Chuck Berry was, so we got to meet Chuck Berry and Keith Richards in the same room. And they were honoring Chuck Berry for his lyrics. It was like this special award. They had a dinner and, you know, and everything, and they were honoring Chuck Berry for his specifically, you know, the way he wrote music and the way he wrote lyrics, which is a really cool thing for you know, Chuck Berry to be recognized for, except for My Ding-a-Ling. So, you know, he got to meet Chuck Berry, shook Chuck Berry's hand and everything, and he was talking about how intimidated he was. He's in, you know, it's Chuck Berry, for God's sake. He's like one of the godfathers of rock and roll, one of the founders of rock and roll, and I get to shake his hand. And then in walks Keith Richards, and Bill says he lost his mind. He's like, ugh. So he ended up like introducing himself and saying, "Hey, I'm a fan," and they end up having a chat. And Bill was doing his imitation of Keith Richards because he got to talk to him a little bit. And he told him how much he meant to him. You know, like Keith Richards, you know, "I just want to say that, you know, you're one of the reasons I got into playing rock, and you're one of my heroes. You're an idol of mine." And he's like, "Oh, thanks, mate." You know, and he goes, "I tell you, I got to feel the same way about Chuck. That's why I'm here." And so he goes, "It's like, I feel that way. You feel that way about me, and I feel that way about Chuck." And so and Bill was doing a much better imitation of Keith Richards than I was, but he was standing there, and like he's having this conversation with Keith Richards about Chuck Berry, and they're agreeing that it's awesome that he's being honored for the lyrics and stuff. And so Bill said that he was standing there talking with Keith Richards. Chuck Berry's like 15 feet away from him, and he just kind of looked around, and it all suddenly hit him like a bolt of lightning. He's like, I'm talking with Keith Richards about Chuck Berry. What is happening? How is this happening right now that I'm talking with Keith Richards about Chuck Berry, and Chuck Berry's like 15 feet away from me?" It's a great story. It's a great story. But that's the only time he ever got to meet Keith Richards. And I asked him, I was like, "Well, did the Stones know about your book?" He's like, "I don't know if they know about my book." He said he tried to get to him, but he got to go through 9,000 people in order to do it. And I'm like, "Yeah, because you should have gave him your book." He goes, "This was before I was," I was writing the book at that time. So that's when it took place. But anyway, I thought I'd share that.
That is pretty cool.
So Chuck Berry, when Berry toured, he never brought a backing band along. Instead, he'd hire unrehearsed guitar-playing kids on the cheap in whatever town or city he was in. When criticized for the practice, he shot back, "Man, if they don't know Chuck Berry, then they don't know rock and roll." See, you can say that. You're a legend when you can say that about yourself. And the fact that it's true, like you're not boasting. If you don't know Chuck Berry, you don't know rock and roll. And that's absolutely true. "Can't argue with that," they said, "because without the licks, the showmanship, the deep connection to R&B, and most important, the lyrics that made Chuck Berry a poet laureate to teenagers everywhere, there would be no rock and roll." Which is true. And it's fantastic that all the stories about how Berry would walk in. A friend of mine went to go see him at Cubby Bear. And this was like late 90s, you know, so he was an older dude at that point. And he's still performing, though. He was still touring and still performing. He demanded cash up front. He would demand cash up front. He's not going to wait for a check to clear. He's not going to wait till after the show. "You pay me when I walk in the door. and that's it. And I want cash. And I'm going to count it in front of you if I have to. So my buddy Mike Meredith went to go see him. And all of a sudden, he's standing. Mike was standing like near the window of the Cubby Bear on the corner. So right on Addison, right at Addison, pulling up right in front at Addison, right at Clark, giant Cadillac. Out walks Chuck Berry with his guitar. Just one guitar in a case. Walks in the front door. Walks up to the stage, goes backstage, presumably asking for his money, gets his money, never met the band, didn't rehearse with the band. They were there. He didn't even know who they were. Never met the band, didn't rehearse, goes backstage, comes back out. He's got a guitar, he's got picks, and he's got a cord. That's it. He plugged in, and he played an hour and a half set. They said it was amazing, that the band actually was good, you know, but they had to follow Chuck. Chuck was obviously the boss on that stage at that time. And he never met these guys before, just walked in, guitar case down, got his money, came back, walked out, did the show. Hour and a half later, he walks off stage after like a couple of encores, walks off stage, gets his guitar case and his bag of money, walks right out the front, gets in the Cadillac, drives away. And that's what Chuck Berry did at every gig.
That's awesome.
Walk in the front door, get his money, play the music, get out. With his money in his Cadillac, drive off. You Chuck Berry, man, you can do that. All right. Let's take a quick break here. I got some weather for you right here. It's going to be a beautiful week. Jeez. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, mostly sunny and a high near 76. Tonight, fair and cool, low around 58. Tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny, high near 80. Wednesday, more sun, high near 84. Thursday, sunny, high near 86. Currently 57 degrees at O'Hare, at 62 at Midway, and 62 at the lakefront. Let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back and talk more about these rock and roll pioneers. Rock and roll wouldn't exist without them. 312-981-7200 if you would like to join us in this conversation. 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here until 5 a.m. Some of you might be wondering why we haven't heard from Esmeralda at all this morning, because Friday was her last show here. The company that she worked for, she didn't work for WGN. She worked for a different company that phased out their radio traffic department, and lots of people lost their jobs, including Esmeralda. And so that's why you don't hear her contributing like she usually does. She is no longer on the show. But she may not be here every single morning, but she is going to be a voice on this show. We're going to bring her back for some the fun, goofy quiz stuff that we've done in the past. We'll bring her back for some would Esmeralda buy that? And just to have her chat about anything she wants to chat about. So she won't be on every morning on the show anymore, but we are going to have her back on. So she's not completely gone, but it makes us really sad. Like I said at the top of the show, to look up at the screen here where I get to see where the cameras are, and to see that the traffic hut is dark with the door closed and Esmeralda's not in there is sad. But anyway, in case people were wondering, you know, so that's what's going on. Anyway, we're back. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN here until 5 a.m. If you would like to join us, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We are talking about true pioneers of rock and roll, like the people that basically invented it. We've got some texts coming in if you wanted to say anything or comment on this. 815 area code says Eric Clapton. See, Eric Clapton, legend, no question about it, one of the most important guitarists, one of the most important musicians in the history of rock and roll. But he's on that sort of second wave, you know? We're talking about right at the beginning of rock and roll, the inventors, the pioneers. And Clapton, although was a pioneer, for sure, in many ways, wasn't one of those original essential pioneers. I'm not taking anything away from him, because I love Eric Clapton. He's one of the greatest guitarists of all time. But he's in that sort of second wave of rock. Kurt says, Chuck Berry would also have the house band tune his guitar before the shows. But this is fantastic. Fantastic, Chuck Berry. Wouldn't even tune his own guitar. Walk in, count the money. They probably tune the guitar while he's counting the money. He's counting the money. He gets one of the house band guys to tune his guitar, and then he just comes out, plays it, leaves. Gets in his Cadillac, drives away. Dan, you ever see the documentary called Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll?
I have not.
It is phenomenal. It's it came out in like 87. Clapton's in it, by the way. And it is a documentary about Chuck Berry made by Taylor Hackford, who made Officer and a Gentleman and Against All Odds and stuff like that. And it's this really, really great documentary, and also a great, great concert footage are in it as well. Lots of Keith Richards is in it. It's basically like a tribute, like they had a tribute concert featuring Chuck Berry and a bunch of other famous musicians who got on stage and jammed, and that was documented, and the surrounding stuff of the movie was basically a documentary about Chuck Berry and his career. And it's called Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, 1987. It's a great movie. It is a really, really great movie. And a lot of, you know, because Chuck Berry, you know, had kind of a questionable past, you know, when it came to women and things like that. He didn't have the best reputation. He was known primarily sometimes as a peeping Tom. And that, when they bring kind of that stuff up, he's like, I don't want to talk. I remember at one part, he's like, I don't want to talk over a desk. I still don't know what that really means, because they're sitting at a desk. And Taylor Hackford starts asking him some questions that clearly Chuck Berry is uncomfortable with and doesn't want to answer. And Chuck Berry's like, don't ask me that in front at a desk. I'm going to be talking about it over a desk. But it's a really terrific movie, very entertaining and honest. You get to learn a lot about Chuck Berry. Not only that, like the obviously, with the kind of talent that showed up at this event, the concert footage is phenomenal. So, all right, how about this one? The Killer, Jerry Lee Lewis. Ivory-thumping, whoop-wailing, crazy-as-a-loon Jerry Lee Lewis slayed us all, setting the world and his piano on fire. Steeped in the music of his native rural Louisiana, the rock and roll wild man, also known as The Killer, shot to fame in 1957 with a Sam Phillips-produced whole lot of shaking going on, including incendiary hits like Great Balls of Fire and Breathless. Heir apparent to Elvis upon the King's 1958 induction into the Army, Lewis saw his career crash after he married his 13-year-old cousin. Jerry Lee never stopped rocking, even to us today, and he's just about the last man standing. Yeah. Did you ever see the movie Great Balls of Fire with Dennis Quaid?
Just bits and pieces of it.
Dennis Quaid, Winona Ryder, played his cousin in it. Alec Baldwin was in that movie. It wasn't a great movie. I was kind of disappointed. I thought Dennis Quaid was really good in it, but I kind of thought it was a bit of a wasted opportunity. But it's such a crazy story. And then they reenact one of the things that he did. He opened for, I want to say it was Little Richard. I think it was Little Richard. And Little Richard was, I guess, you know, talking trash about Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, about how he's not as good a performer as he is. And so Little Richard came out and was waiting in the wings, and he opened for him. Jerry Lee Lewis opened for Little Richard. He opened for Little Richard, and he goes completely nuts on stage, like completely, you know, like going completely crazy on stage, giving an unbelievably wild, insane performance. And then he set the piano on fire, like right there, just boom, in flames. The piano's burning on stage. He walks off the stage to the side of the stage. Little Richard is standing there, and he goes, "Follow that, killer." And then he walked off the stage. And I think it was Little Richard. It could have been somebody else, but I know that you know, legendary sort of story about how he set the piano on fire, and he was only supposed to do like two subdued songs. He ended up doing like four songs and setting the piano on fire and going nuts and then walking off and saying, "Follow that." Okay, next here, as one of the pioneers, Ike Turner. His name will forever be linked with domestic violence and eclipsed by his brilliantly talented ex-wife, Tina Turner. But Ike Turner was a musical pioneer behind Rocket 88, the 1951 single that many consider to be the first rock and roll record ever. Although it was credited to Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats, the number one hit was actually recorded by Ike Turner's Kings of Rhythm. Yeah, Rocket 88 is, many, many people do consider it to be the first rock and roll record ever made. So, Bill Haley, portly, kind of square, with a goofy spit curl on his forehead, Bill Haley didn't look like much of a rocker, and in fact, he was more of a country artist. But the 1954 Rock Around the Clock, Haley and His Comets, gave the world its first rock and roll hit. The song that brought this alchemy of R&B and hillbilly music into the mainstream became popular. Before long, he was eclipsed by the likes of Elvis, Jerry Lee, Buddy Holly, and still, Haley continued rocking around the clock at the nostalgia concerts and county fairs right up until his death in 1981. And also, Rock Around the Clock featured in the movie Blackboard Jungle, which was a very controversial movie when it came out. Tame by today's standards. It was about troubled teens and punks in school, older film. But it opened up with rock and roll, a Rock Around the Clock, which, you know, sounds like a tame kind of a novel, not novelty, but nostalgia song now. But that was a revolutionary song. Nothing sounded like that in the mainstream. Nothing at all sounded like Rock Around the Clock. And its spirit, its lyrics, it was revolutionary. And to have it as part of this movie that was about delinquency, it also added a little extra layer to it. Like, you know, more of a myth was added to it because this movie is about teen delinquency and stuff like that. And then, of course, it was used for the first season of Happy Days as well. So Bill Haley, one of the rock and roll pioneers, which is what we're talking about. We're talking about rock and roll pioneers. And if you'd like to join us with a talk or a text, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. All right, the news is coming up next. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Then we're here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. In just a few minutes, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because every Monday morning he calls in and tells a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich will follow this show at 5 with the opening bell. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday morning. Welcome back, everybody. And we're here. And we're talking about pioneers, real true originators, pioneers of rock and roll. And we've been telling some stories about them and remembering some of the ones that that really invented the genre. 815 area code says Carl Perkins, and that's up next. Already known as the king of rockabilly, Carl Perkins, the composer of the seminal Blue Suede Shoes and a guitar lick master who influenced everyone from Elvis to the Beatles, was on his way to the top of the rock and roll heap at a national TV appearance when his car hit the back of a pickup truck, causing severe injury. By the time Perkins got out of the hospital, Elvis Presley had made headlines with an April 1956 performance on the Milton Berle Show. Among the songs that Presley performed that night was Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes. Yeah. There's a lot of incidents that are kind of sad, you know, involving some of the legacies that were, you know, that were tarnished or ended, you know, and in the case of Buddy Holly, you know, plane crash, he dies at 22. 630 area code, Jeff Beck. Again, like Eric Clapton, he's in that second wave. I wouldn't call him, you know, an originator. I wouldn't call him a true pioneer at the beginning of rock and roll, because he's in that second wave. He's certainly phenomenal, certainly an important figure in the history of rock and roll and music, but I don't think that his time frame fits into what we're talking about. 815 area code. How about Les Paul? Yeah, how about Les Paul? Les Paul's not on this list.
That is surprising.
How is that possible? I don't understand that. That's really crazy. By the way, you guys can still pick up Steve and Johnny's book, A Little More Less. It's still out there, and it's a great book, a terrific book. And I would imagine that if Steve and Johnny were here, they would not be happy that an article talking about, you know, the pioneers of rock and roll does not have Les Paul on it. That's a glaring omission, an absolute glaring omission. 519 says also Bill Haley. Frank says Earl Hickey was a rockabilly artist who was a big influence on a lot of the guys on this list. Yeah, the rockabilly guys who got their start also influencing. 765, Bo Diddley built his own guitar, created his own sound. Nobody else like him. Well, he's next, featured in this article. The great Bo Diddley. He wasn't the only father of rock and roll, but Mississippi-born, Chicago-raised Bo Diddley made sure the music had plenty of DNA in the form of the blues and his patented Bo Diddley beat, derived from African rhythms known to guitarists worldwide as the mother of all riffs. Diddley influenced not only rock and roll, but also rap and hip-hop. He also had a penchant for unforgettable album titles like Have Guitar, Will Travel, Bo Diddley is a Gunslinger, Bo Diddley is a Lover, 500% more man. Bo Diddley. Here's a big one. Gene Vincent, another country boy with authentic rock and roll looks. He outdid Elvis with his self-penned 1956 hit Bebop-a-Lua. But while Vincent recorded numerous follow-ups, he never was able to repeat the original chart success that he had, eventually spending much of his time touring Europe. Another rock and roll pioneer, Fats Domino, with hits like Blueberry Hill, I'm Walkin', Ain't That a Shame, and the Fat Man inspired several generations of artists, especially the British bands that invaded the U.S. in the mid-60s. Seemingly immune to rock and roll strife and scandal, Domino continued to perform right up until his death last year. Richie Valens. This story also is paired with Buddy Holly. Valens' recording career spanned only 8 months, from July 1958 to February 1959. He died in the same plane crash that killed Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper. Still, the Mexican-American singer-songwriter demonstrated that if you could get your hands on a cheap guitar, you could rock the world, even in Spanish, as evidenced by La Bamba, which entered the top 40 just 2 weeks before Valens' death at the age of 17. Made a movie out of that one, too. La Bamba with Lou Diamond Phillips. Another really good movie and a really good performance. That's a good rock and roll movie. How about this one? The Everly Brothers. Radio child stars in the late 40s, Don and Phil Everly harmonized their way to rock and roll immortality with such hits as Wake Up Little Susie, All I Have to Do Is Dream, and Bye Bye Love, melding country with the emerging sound of rock and roll. Difficulties with their record company, amphetamine addiction and military addiction and military service took them out of the spotlight by the early 60s. And when the British invasion hit in 1964, the Everly Brothers were viewed as old hat. Ironically, the brothers subsequently saw great success in the UK, where their appeal stayed strong. Though famous for their sibling rivalry, Don and Phil reunited in 2003 to join mega fans Simon and Garfunkel on tour. Yeah, those guys were great. Eddie Cochran. Before his 1960 death in a car crash while touring the UK, Cochran hit rock and roll gold with his teenage anthem Summertime Blues, one of the most influential and covered songs in the history of rock and roll. It's true. Another tragedy. Yeah, you know, you look back at some of these guys, you know, that were true originators and true pioneers of rock, and there are a lot of tragedies associated with these. You know, some sad stories. Eddie Cochran, 1960, died in a car crash. Summertime Blues is one of the greatest. Yeah, that's one of the, it's like one of the best songs ever. So, how about this one? Dion. One of the very few rockers then and now who could swing like Sinatra, Bronx-born Dion DiMucci, took the multicultural sounds of the New York City streets, black blues clubs, and even Hank Williams tunes he heard on the radio. He shuffled them all together. He put on a bow tie and then grand slammed all-out rock and roll ballpark. Just listen to Run Around Sue or The Wanderer. So, all right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us with your thoughts on the true originators of rock and roll, the pioneers. And we're going back here, going back to the early days. Let's see. Next is Link Wray. When Link Wray released his power chord heavy distorted electric guitar charged Rumble in 1958, it became the only instrumental ever to be banned from radio out of fear that it might incite gang violence. So this, an instrumental was banned from the radio. Wow. All right. In this case, the guardians of polite society may have been right. Sunglasses wearing, leather clad, and badass to the core, Ray created a sound that would rumble its way to the core of metal, punk, and grunge. Yeah. And by the way, that that Link Wray song was the original theme to Svengoolie. Was the theme for the original Svengoolie. It was that. And they would add screaming. They would add a woman screaming, and that was when Jerry G. Bishop was the original. So, now see, here's the thing, though. Link Wray, clearly an innovator, no question about it. But if Link Ray's on here, and Les Paul isn't, there's something wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean,
the reason why they picked Link Ray is because he's been an innovator, you know, changed like the sound of things. That's all that, I mean, you want to talk about innovation. So, I don't know. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us talking about some rock and roll legends. How about this one? Roy Orbison, called the Caruso of rock. He had a pure, beautiful voice, yet nobody ever laid down a more primal growl than Roy Orbison on Oh, Pretty Woman, with hits like In Dreams, Crying, and Only the Lonely. He projected a vulnerability unusual in early rock and roll, and his life was marked by tragedy. But Orbison continued to perform and record, which led to a career revival in the 80s, when he began performing with George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, and Jeff Lynne as the Traveling Wilburys. He died in 1988, right at the height of his career resurgence. Man, I remember when the Wilburys album, the first Wilburys album, came out. I mean, that was huge. That was really huge. Yeah, and you know, it was weird because the Wilburys stuff came out, and then David Lynch releases Blue Velvet, which contains the candy colored clown they call the Sandman, that with lip sync by Dean Stockwell, which is like one of the legendary scenes in that movie. And then that song became a hit. It was you know, the Wilburys record came out, it was huge, and he like put out some solo stuff. And then you're right, he had about three and a half, four years of resurgent success thanks to that 80s revival, and then he died. So Roy Orbison. Okay, a few more here that we're going to get to, but we're going to take a break here. We got weather, and we're going to break and come back, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's Monday, and it's a jokey time. And if you want to comment on any of this rock and roll pioneer stuff, we would love to hear from you. Talk or text 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey time. It's a jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey time. It's a jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
That's right. My dad tells a joke. Every Monday morning, my dad tells a joke. How are you? It's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 with the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Every Monday morning, my dad tells a joke, and we always have a good time with that. So let's welcome my dad to the show. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Doing good.
All right. How's Ma?
Doing fine.
All right, good. Got a joke.
Got a joke.
All right.
The guy walks into the hardware store and asks the manager for a tool to break up hard ground. The manager showed him a wall of shovels, hoes, and other tools and says, take your pick.
All right. There you go. I got it.
Okay.
All right.
Bye, Nick.
See ya.
Bye.
See you later. There you go. There's my dad. Take your pick. Oh, boy. All right.
That was jokey time. It was a jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
Yeah, he did. And he'll do it again. He'll do it again next week. You know, he should have personalized it and said it was Lou Manfredini.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that Lou's a fan of the jokes.
Yeah. Lou Manfredini says, take your pick. All right. My dad will come back and tell another joke next week. So our phone number is 312-981-7200. We've been talking about the true originators, the pioneers of rock and roll, and hearing some interesting stories about them. And I got a few more here to talk about. And if you want to jump in with your comments, I would love to read them via text or talk to you via phone at 312-981-7200. Next here is Alan Freed. He couldn't play or sing, yet Alan Freed sits high in the rock and roll pantheon. As an early Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, the radio disc jockey was the first to popularize the term rock and roll and served as its first ambassador. Freed fell on hard times in the late 50s when he was busted in the infamous Payola scandal and exposed for taking bribes to play certain songs and taking songwriting credits before doing so. Still, Freed had great taste, stealing in partial from the likes of Chuck Berry. It was wrong, but Berry never forgave Freed for it, and it was rock and roll. They also made a movie out of that, too. All of these movies, it was American Hot Wax was the movie, which is actually another really good movie. Jay Leno's in that movie. If I remember correctly, he's in a doo-wop group, like on the street. Can't remember the actor who played Alan Freed, though. I think Fran Drescher was in that movie, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, American Hot Wax. That was a good film, and it was about the whole Alan Freed story. And how what he did by playing this music and championing this music was very controversial and very unusual.
Tim McIntyre?
Yeah. He never went on to, I don't think that guy went on to do anything else. He's good in the movie. He's really good in American Hot Wax, but I don't think the guy really had much of a career outside of that. If I remember correctly, Floyd Mutrix directed that movie. And Floyd Mutrix, I think he directed it. I'm pretty sure he directed it.
Yes.
He had a real interesting career. He did some really interesting stuff in the 70s, and culminating in one of the most ridiculous comedies ever, The Hollywood Nights, which Robert Wall made his film debut in that movie. It's a movie that took place in the early 60s, and it was about this, you know, this sort of gang, goofballs, of, you know, that are in a car club. And it takes place on Halloween night in, I want to say, 61 or 2. Tony Danza's in it. Michelle Pfeiffer's first movie. And Robert Wool played Newbomb Turk. And it came out in the summer of 1980. And I don't know what he did after that. Like, he had a few really interesting and cool genre movies in the 70s. And then Hollywood Nights was in the 80s. And I don't know what Mutrix did after that. But he had a really niche career at that time, mid to late 70s, and then culminating with Hollywood Nights, which became a cult classic. People love that movie. I love that movie. I was 15 when it came out. I thought it was hilarious. And Robert Wool was hilarious in it. He was great. And it was the first time he ever made any kind of impression. He would end up to go to do stand-up. What was that? What the hell was the name of that show? Oh, Arliss.
Arliss, yeah.
Yeah. That show was on for 15 too many seasons, like 10 too many seasons. Okay, next, after Alan Freed, we got Ricky Nelson. Another tragedy. Jeez. He didn't wiggle or swivel, nor did he shake, rattle, and roll. He didn't have to. Ricky Nelson had those dreamy eyes. And though he was from Southern California, a former child actor and the son of TV stars Ozzie and Harriet Nelson, Ricky, with songs like Traveling Man and Bebop Baby, would rock and roll with a cool style all his own. If you doubt Nelson's importance, read Bob Dylan's memoir Chronicles, in which he spends paragraphs rhapsodizing over Ricky's sound and chill rock and roll persona. And then finally, you can't make a list of rock and roll pioneers without including the Beatles. You just can't. Seek out the Beatles live at the BBC recordings from radio gigs that they did on the eve of Beatlemania. What you'll hear is a sound influenced by everyone from Elvis and Buddy Holly to Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, performed with pure joy, every note and lick and vocal honed during their 8-hour marathon sets on stage at the Hamburg Star Club. Then listen to the Fab Four studio albums, and all the pioneers are found there as well. Moving into the future, the Beatles began to take rock and roll into a whole new direction, ushering in that second era that we were talking about. So there they are, 20 essential rock and roll pioneers who were there at the beginning.
There's an interesting book that came out a few years ago called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
Uh-huh.
And in there, he makes a hypothesis that to become a master of something, you have to do something for 10,000 hours. That's the threshold in order to become amazing.
Really?
And one of the examples he points to is the Beatles, and the fact that they had to play those 8-hour shows in Hamburg you know, they do that for a couple months, all of a sudden those hours add up quickly, and by the time that, you know, they hit it big, they'd reached that 10,000 hour plateau.
It makes sense. I mean, you know, the trajectory of their career is insane. And the fact that they were together for like 9 years, they were only together for like 9 years, it's just like crazy. 8-9 years, and they get that all done. It's insane. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. A couple of more here. 847 area code says Brian Wilson. Yeah, there's a good argument for Brian Wilson, certainly. One of the biggest innovators in rock. There's no question about it. I mean, if you know, Pet Sounds was a game changer. You know, Pet Sounds, the release of Pet Sounds is responsible for Sgt. Pepper, because the Beatles heard Pet Sounds and went, we need to do something now. Because I believe we just heard the greatest album ever recorded, so that kicked them in the butt, so that they did Pepper. 773 area code says Dick Dale. Well, Dick Dale also had a very distinctive style. And if they're going to include, again, if they're going to include Link Wray, why not Dick Dale?
Right.
Dick Dale,
right? I would go Dick Dale over Link Wray, just because, you know, I might not know a Link Wray song, you know, besides Rumble, but you could identify a Dick Dale song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question about it. 815 area code says Brenda Lee and Connie Francis. You know what? There's not a woman on that list.
Yeah, it's a real shame.
I didn't even realize that. There's not a woman on that list.
Yeah.
That's a crime.
I mean, you could go with Mary Ford if you're doing Les Paul.
Right.
But unfortunately, they just weren't given opportunities back then.
Right. That's, you know what, it was the time period as well. That's, you know, it's a shame that they weren't recognized. Like Brenda Lee and Connie Francis certainly would be considered pioneers of music in general. It's just that, yeah, you're right. The politics and the opportunities from that time just didn't exist. They didn't exist. So anyway, interesting stories, and some of them tinged with a little sadness. But I think we can all agree that Les Paul was a glaring omission from that article. Okay. Let's take a break. Dan, we've got tomorrow we have
Larry Garrett sharing his amazing September 11th story.
Yeah, he's got an amazing September 11th story. He's also a hypnotist. Helped Bob Collins quit smoking. And it's the anniversary of September 11th tomorrow. So, all right, we'll take a break. And the news is coming up in seconds.